So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
Tonight's broadcast brought to you by coffee with cream and sugar and a ginger ale. Lots of caffeine.
I've actually stopped using sugar in my coffees.
Oh, really? Yeah. I'm tempted to make that change, to be honest.
I prefer it, actually, because, I don't know, I guess the sugar just seems to leave a bit of a residue.
I find that place across the street,
yeah.
I think I'm done.
Why?
I've been the one supporting that fucking place.
And why are you done?
She puts the sugar at like a spoonful of it, but doesn't stir it. And I understand I can stir it. I can do that. I'm not.
You shouldn't
that
have to do it. She has the spoon.
I
she
know.
Should stir it.
I know. I don't have a spoon here at work to stir with, even. I don't think we have cutlery.
We
in
have
this place.
Stir sticks.
Anyway, I was driving though into work because sometimes I'll leave early from my house and I'll drive all the way down to that fucking Tim Hortons way down Dundas.
Oh, okay.
But if I'm going to do that, that's a fair. Out of the way to go grab a coffee at Tim
Just
Hortons.
Just to go to Tim Hortons?
I really like Tim Hortons. I know you don't like it.
Why don't you?
However, you're probably going to say what I discovered this week. I was driving up. I don't want to say where I live. I was driving up a street, made a right at Bloor, and there's this hidden Tim Hortons right there at Bloor and Keel.
Secret Tim Hortons.
I've gone there the last 2 days before work. And
wow. Congratulations.
I might not go back to Galaxy, unfortunately. I like to support the smaller places, but...
I don't know why you don't just get coffee in the office. We have a fantastic coffee machine.
Because I brought in a coffee mug, and other people were taking it and using
just
it.
Use, so. Why don't you just use the coffee mugs here?
Have you seen the coffee mugs here?
I have.
They don't fucking clean
I'm using
them.
One right now.
They're disgusting, dude.
They do clean them.
Once a week.
Yeah, and they're clean when they get used.
Like, multiple people are using this. Multiple people are putting their lips all over that and diseased. It's gross, dude.
Well, thank you.
No, thanks. Enjoy.
Mmm.
This is the best start ever.
Welcome to the greatest sports entertainment spectacular of all time. Welcome to WrestleMania.
It is an enthralling legacy.
The irresistible force meeting the immovable object.
Moments that resound through the ages.
Champion against champion, title against title. This is what it's all about.
An event that captivates the heart of an entire world. This is a night that carries us back to the enchanting world of our youth. Spectacle that rejuvenates our spirit.
Tyson! 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 Right here! There goes Michaels!
Welcome to WrestleMania, the showcase of the immortals.
It doesn't get any bigger or more exciting than this! Tonight, heroes will be made and careers and lives shaped forever!
Welcome to WrestleMania, a celebration of life.
Welcome to Review Away, everybody. My name is John Pollock, and I'm joined by Wei Ting. And first of all, Wei Ting, the show hasn't even begun yet. You're going to be the MVP of this week's show.
Why is that?
I come into work, and I come by your desk. I notice that you're here earlier than usual, and I see that you are on the Triple H Undertaker match. And part of me is like, man, what a trooper here, getting through this. But on the other hand, I'm thinking, he has no idea how much more he probably has to watch here.
It's not true.
Main event was long, dude. That was a half-hour match.
Well, I was watching online, and I could see the bar.
Oh.
It told me how much I had to watch.
That's true.
Yeah. It's not a commendable effort. I wanted to watch this last night. I was so tired last night, and I fell asleep.
See, I knew ahead of time this was like a 4-hour show. I was going to have to break it up. So I went through a bunch of it on Sunday, did some more on actually Tuesday morning. We had our preview show.
Uh-huh.
So we don't meet till like 10 a.m. And I was up at like 7:30.
Oh,
went
wow.
through some more then.
You're good with that, with, pacing yourself.
Yeah, I hate like WrestleMania 1. I left right till the night before last time. And
mm-hmm.
granted, it's a fast show. It's not a long, it's like 2 hours and change.
Yeah.
But this one, three sittings I had to go through.
This is a very long show. Did they do 4-hour shows before this one?
This would, no, the year prior, I think, was the first time they did close to a 4-hour show. Typically, WrestleManias are like 3.5 hours. This one was like 3:45, I'm guessing, something mm-hmm. in that range.
Yeah,
so,
I'm trying to think. Yes, about that much.
A lot. When you consider back then, you had Sunday Night Heat before it as well. They were still doing the 1 hour before that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, afterwards, Toronto, you were listening to The Law for 2 hours.
Wow, that's a big day.
And then come back for two more the next night on Monday.
And exactly. And if you're a really hardcore fan, you would have been watching Bite This.
Oh, yeah.
On WWE.com, which was streaming
with Kevin Kelly.
With that entire weekend, and of course hosted by Kevin Kelly, who will be our guest coming up.
We are going to be joined live, well, taped live with Kevin Kelly, everybody. He's going to be chatting with us about WrestleMania X7. We have lots of questions for him, because this really way a very historically significant show in WWE history. Some would say the best WrestleMania of all time. I'm not really going to argue that point. It's tremendous show.
A tremendous show, top to bottom. And I think what added to the mystique was that it was the first show since, what, WrestleMania, six, that they did in a stadium.
They did WrestleMania 8 at the Hoosier Dome.
Okay.
Which I guess was...
First one since then.
But that was a heavily papered show. I mean, this was a show that they were successful to draw a stadium show.
Yeah. Is that the Indianapolis one, the Hoosier
Yes,
Dome?
Yes.
Okay, that would have been
so
seven.
So even still, that's 9 years before.
Yeah, WrestleMania returning. 7 was that one.
WrestleMania 8 was the Hoosier Dome.
Really? Okay, never mind.
Is Wikipedia saying otherwise?
WrestleMania.
Look it up.
I am. You're right. WrestleMania 8 at the Hoosier Dome. Yes.
Did we review that one last year? I think we did.
I think so, too.
Let's look it up. Kidding. All right, WrestleMania X7 way. We should get into things. I have a lot of pages here. Granted, some of this is feedback. I think we got more feedback to this WrestleMania than any other one.
Yeah, perhaps, because we sure didn't get that much for WrestleMania 1.
Now, going into this show, Wei, I always like looking at these different years and time periods of where your viewing habits were, because typical wrestling fans watched it as a child, fell out of it during the lean years, came back in the late 90s, and probably tuned out right after this show.
Mm-hmm.
So where did you fit in here at WrestleMania X7?
I remember watching it pretty closely by this point. In the year leading up to it, at least. And all I remember around this time was just I was in high school, in grade 12, in my desktop publishing class. I actually had a class that taught me Photoshop.
Wow.
It was a really good class. Anyway, it was great because all we did was sit in front of computers and go online.
I had a class like that in grade 12, too, or grade 11. One of them was. It was just like computer publishing or something, and it was internet surfing.
Exactly. And then all my friends and I would do would be go online and look up wrestling sites, the cool people that we were. And I just remember reading about the WWF's purchase of WCW. In my class, and just being so hyped about that event. And that was, of course, the go-home show leading to this Mania.
Yes, it was March 23rd, 2001, where the news came out that WCW had been purchased by the World Wrestling Federation, and that added a ton to the go-home show on Raw,
mm-hmm.
where they basically, it was like the biggest story in probably 20 years, and on top of that, it was going into the most successful show up till that point in WWF history. Mm-hmm. So it was like a phenomenal news period for the company where all of this was happening. And this was only a month after ECW had also gone out of business. Mm-hmm. So there were so many questions going into WrestleMania that year and how everything was going to shape up. Looking at it from the surface way at the time, it was like, man, you're going to have this massive WrestleMania show, and then you have the chance to do the biggest storyline in wrestling history with WCW coming mm-hmm. in. It was like, this company is just going to has a license to print money.
Yeah.
Or burn it. I, on one hand, was extremely optimistic at this point that it's like, even an idiot wouldn't fuck this up, and this company has been brilliant for 3 years.
I think we all were. I think every fan was just salivating at the possibilities that were to come out of this great show.
It's like, this company has WCW. They can bring in this ECW talent. Mm-hmm. You can do like a promotional war here with all of the key players. Man, do we sound so stupid now in hindsight. Oh.
I would love to pull back an episode of The Law from way back then and listen to that to see what people's opinions were at that time.
I would too. I don't know if we have, because you see, I wasn't there at the time, so I don't know the archiving situation at that specific time period.
Uh-oh. Well.
Well, look it up.
Oh, well. Gone forever.
Yes. Oh, well, let's get into this. WrestleMania opens up with, of course, I'd be remiss if we didn't mention the video going into WrestleMania that we saw the weeks leading up to it, the My Way video with Austin and Rock.
Yeah.
I don't think any wrestling fan will ever hear that song and not think of WrestleMania 17.
Hmm. Yeah.
It was just incredibly well done.
Yeah, it was. And we can talk more about it when we actually get to the match itself.
Well, I was going to lead it in because the video to start off WrestleMania, usually it's a big epic start to WrestleMania.
Yeah.
This was a weird video. It started with these country folks, which is all I can describe them as, watching old clips of WrestleMania throughout the years. In their barn. Then we see Japanese people in the street watching Yokozuna winning the title at WrestleMania 9.
I believe they're actually Chinese in Chinatown.
Well, they weren't Samoan, which is what Yokozuna was. Then there's people at barbershops in probably the oddest hours of a barbershop to be open that late on a Sunday night to be watching WrestleMania and probably getting an illegal version of WrestleMania a commercial establishment.
How are any of these people ordering this pay-per-view on their remote TVs, these handheld TVs?
They did not have boxes. And I don't know how WrestleMania was getting broadcast in the street.
I don't know. In Chinatown?
Sure. Maybe they were at Pacific Mall. Yes. They don't pay for anything there.
That's true.
And then they show other people at work watching WrestleMania, not getting their job done. These people would have been fired if they were caught watching WrestleMania at work.
These people are coming in on Sunday nights.
Get back to work!
And then we see these two teenagers, these homeless teenagers watching WrestleMania.
This was on Queen Street, apparently.
Inside a beat-down car. A TV inside a car.
That wasn't even the highlight of it, because it even got better. This is all voiced by Freddie Blassie, which was great. And he welcomes us to the Showcase of the Immortals, okay, and a celebration of life. And over the years, they have added this tagline as one of the buzz terms for WrestleMania, a celebration of life. Okay. That's too much hyperbole for me. This is not a celebration of life. To me, that line, yeah. Come on, okay? Right. We're watching entertainment.
All right, what about a showcase of the immortals?
That I can take, sure.
None of these guys are immortal.
Well, that, to me, I can buy that easier than a celebration of life.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yes.
And then it ends with these Tibetan monks dancing in a field. This was fucked, dude. Just fucked.
I think this was their attempt to capture maybe what the Olympics does every year, and maybe just going too far.
From the Tibetan monks, we go to Snickers Cruncher is the title sponsor of this show. The opening here, I remember watching this, and just the fact that they were going to be in a major dome, to me, was a big draw. Yeah. Just seeing these guys perform in front of that many people, I'm a big fan of the dome shows. I know a lot of people don't like them, but I think for once a year, it makes your talent look like immortals.
If you can fill the dome with a really hot crowd, then absolutely. And this set looked so good.
This was like the greatest set up until that point in wrestling.
I would say even today.
Like, there were some Japan shit, like especially the New Japan and All Japan Women. They had some crazy stuff. I think this was kind of almost inspired by some of the Japanese sets that they would use, and we'd see in Pride.
I'm just trying to think back of all the WrestleManias and all the sets that they've had ever since then. This one still stands up to me.
To be honest, the next year when we went to 18, that was one of the disappointments.
I was so disappointed.
Set, it was like this structural.
It just looked
terrible.
I think I remember seeing. Seeing photos of it online or seeing it on Heat or something, and I had thought, even walking into the arena, that they hadn't completed the set yet for 18 at the Sky Dome. I thought that they were still building this as we were coming into the stadium, but that was it. But this set, in contrast, was just amazing. And the Astrodome itself is just a tremendous looking building with a domed roof similar to Madison Square Garden. Where every shot you took, it was just this like globe that you're surrounded by, and the crowd looked amazing too.
They looked phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I was really glad because earlier this week I finished the WrestleMania documentary, and they actually had a big discussion about performing in small venues versus the big stadium shows. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a split amongst the roster in terms of reactions and stuff. And we can get into that a little later on. Well, some interesting perspectives.
Yeah, we could talk about it now. I mean, in the documentary, they mentioned how, and we see we see a lot of the wrestlers talk about it, about how sound will travel much differently when you're inside a dome compared to like a hockey arena.
Because in a big dome, the sound travels up. It goes right up.
And so like you hear someone like Edge in that documentary talking about how when they were wrestling this TLC match, how they really weren't sure why the audience wasn't reacting as they were doing all their moves, and they thought that they were having a good match, but they knew afterwards that it was only because of the size of the arena that the sound would travel so far. And so you would have to figure, looking at this roster, it would be all these guys first time wrestling in a place this big.
Yeah, and watching it on TV, it was interesting to hear Edge talk about that, because watching it on TV, I thought the crowd heat came across really well.
Yeah.
It sounded like a giant throng of people, not the kind of same reaction you'll get to, for instance, The Rock just coming back a couple of weeks ago. I mean, that pop was just, it's a different kind of sound because you're in an enclosed space.
It's an even bigger sound, though. Like, it's a sound that you would hear at a Super Bowl, or the sound you would hear at a World Series.
Yeah. I, to this day, of all the shows I've been to, I've never been to a match with more heat than Hogan Rock.
Yep.
And that's, right inside of a dome. It was... That crowd was just insane there. And the start of that match, things were shaking. It was just incredible, the heat for that match.
Yeah, and I mean, just thinking about that feeling of just being in a crowd full of everybody cheering is really one of the reasons why I am even considering going into the UFC at the Rogers Center coming up. Mm-hmm. Just to experience that energy from a huge crowd, it really is worth the money for it to go, just to say that you've experienced that.
We've got Jim Ross and Paul Heyman on commentary, and then they cut to WWF New York. Heyman plugs that this is his first WrestleMania, and they immediately get into things right away. The opening match, Chris Jericho defending the Intercontinental Championship against William Regal. They show a video here previewing this match with Regal's entrance. Regal then throwing the right to censor and the Dudleys at Chris Jericho in the weeks leading up to this, but Jericho overcomes both. They show the angle where Jericho pees into the tee of Regal, and this was all designed for Regal's facials, which were fantastic after drinking this tea. And then Jericho showing up as Doink on the go-home Raw to attack Regal. And crowd was hot, I thought, here right at the start. And we get right into things. Jericho slingshots himself to the floor and overshoots Regal in one of the early spots of the match. Then hits a reverse elbow off the top for the first pinfall attempt of the match. Regal's chest, you can see, it's all pink here from these chops by Jericho, who's just laying it right in on Regal. And then Jericho's thrown into the post left shoulder first and does it twice, and it plays off an injury angle from TV, so Jericho begins selling the shoulder throughout the match. He fights back using his right arm and shoulder, and he attempts the lion salt but gets hit by the knees of Regal. Then Regal takes the turnbuckle pad off and throws Jericho's shoulder into that. Jericho comes back with two enziguris. I thought Jericho's selling was very, very good here, even pushing off with his right arm for the Irish whip and just little things of, working with your right side very lends itself to selling the left side a lot better. Then we see a double underhook suplex by Regal off of the top. Jericho goes for the walls of Jericho, but it's countered into the Regal stretch, and then all of the pressure is on the left shoulder, but he's still able to reach the ropes. Comes back with chops to Regal, and then Regal is tossed into the exposed turnbuckle, takes a face plant, a vertical suplex, and a lion salt for Chris Jericho to retain the title. So
yes.
I thought this was a good match. Jericho said in his book he wasn't too happy with this WrestleMania match, but I mean, it's not a classic, but I thought it was, you know, a good
solid
match
opener
to start. Yeah, nothing.
Finish was a little messed up with Regal being out of position for the lion salt. You could hear them talking, and Jericho had to reposition him. But otherwise, I thought it was a very good match. Not enough to stand out on this card, though.
No.
Nobody remembers.
This is definitely in the lower rung. Yeah. A limousine arrives with the license plate WCW1, and Shane McMahon gets out, and they mention that he has bought WCW based off the angle from Monday night. We go to the APA and Jacqueline, and Bradshaw wants to know where Taz is. Farouk responds, he's doing his thug thing. And Bradshaw cuts a big promo on all the football players he's watched here at the Astrodome for the hometown pop. It pumps up Farouk and Jacqueline as they head to the ring.
It's hard for me to even imagine JBL as a babyface. I don't even remember this time, but he actually does a pretty good job here.
It's such a different character, and that's why when he first moved over to JBL, it was a big changeover, because it was, okay, we've watched this beer-drinking redneck, and now all of a sudden he's a financial advisor on Wall Street. We go to our second match of the night. Val Venus, Bull Buchanan, and the Good Father, accompanied by Steven Richards as the Right to Censor, taking on the APA and Taz, who are accompanied by Jacqueline. Ross calls the RTC extreme, and Heyman objects to that term, and he says he's not a fan of censorship. Richards tries to cut a promo, but it's cut off by Taz's theme, and all of them fight on the floor to start the match. Taz and Venus start in the ring as the bell rings. Jacqueline hits a DDT to Richards inside the ring, and then we go to Farouk and Buchanan, who Buchanan runs up to the top of the top rope and hits this reverse elbow off of the top rope. RTC gets the heat with a big boot by Buchanan to Taz, and then keeps Taz in their corner. Venus and the Good Father then send Taz into the ropes, and he nearly falls through here. He like lost his footing as he was being thrown into the ropes. Good Father then hits what was formerly the Ho Train to no reaction, and then he misses a Vader bomb, and it leads to the hot tag to Bradshaw. Ross compares Bradshaw to Dick Murdoch and Stan Hansen. Then we see a reverse slam by Bradshaw to Venus. The APA then hits a double spinebuster to Val Venus, and Bradshaw hits a back suplex off the top rope to Venus. Buchanan and Godfather then hit a double...
Godfather.
Oh, sorry. Buchanan and the Good Father hit a double powerbomb to Bradshaw. Goodfather sets him up for the Ho Train, misses it in the turnbuckle as Bradshaw rebounds off the ropes and hits the clothesline from hell to get the win for the babyfaces.
This was like 4 minutes long for...
That's all it needed to be.
Yeah, but everything just seemed so rushed. Everybody was just trying to get their spots in, and it just looked like, you know, maybe some of these guys looked a bit too excited. But, you know, that's what happens when you have so many people in such little time.
Jacqueline got her WrestleMania moment by DDTing Richards.
Yeah. It was all right.
It was a six-man tag.
Yeah, high energy.
Promo airs for the WrestleMania magazine, which is available now for $9.99. Then we get a Shop Zone ad also promoting this magazine. It's a hell of a magazine to get away. Heyman then has to do the Snickers Cruncher ad, and he did this awesome with this crazy voice. Stephanie is then backstage and walks into Trish Stratus and Linda, who is sedated in her wheelchair, and says that at least Linda had one child that turned out well. And then Stephanie tells Trish that after Vince beats Shane tonight, that they need lots of champagne and strawberries, and instructs her how to crush the ice. Yeah. And Trish agrees and says it will be done.
I hated this storyline. Linda.
Linda was great in this.
I think I've heard people say that. I think I've heard you say that. But fuck, like, it just looks so goofy. Okay, a woman sitting in a wheelchair, blankly staring. Linda McMahon trying to act, even if it is trying to act like a like she's in a coma. It's so ridiculous. So ridiculous.
Look at the context of what we're watching here. Look at some of the shit on this show when you say ridiculous. We just watched
a
group of four men that walk around in white and want to censor.
Yeah, okay. But anyway.
All right.
We'll go on.
Next up going to go to the match featuring the man who was burnt as a child and has tried to murder his parents. It's Raven, Kane, and Big Show for the hardcore title. Raven's theme music, everybody. It's like this rock theme with a bird chirping.
Yeah, Raven.
It's
a crow.
It has zero connection to his character other than Jim Johnson, who said, this guy's name is Raven.
Mm-hmm.
Make music for him. Okay. We'll get a raven chirping over music.
Would you prefer a Pearl Jam ripoff? Or what did he come out to? A Nirvana ripoff? He
came out to Offspring, yeah.
No, Nirvana didn't. Oh, and WCW.
Hey, WCW came out to the Nirvana ripoff. Well, stealing from the best. Raven attacks Kane before Big Show arrives. Kane then press slams Raven to the floor when Big Show arrives and catches him. Kane goes off the top rope with a clothesline to the Big Show on the floor and then goes for a cover because it's falls count anywhere in these hardcore rules. And the three then fight into the audience. This was awesome because they cut to a camera that could not find them. And the cameraman is getting stormed by the crowd as he's trying to like shove the fans out of the way so mm-hmm. that he can find the talent. Very funny. Raven reappears with a cookie sheet and hits the head of Kane as they go backstage. This was odd. You have 67,000 people, and we're going to go brawl backstage.
That was the type of match that they were doing. This is their opinion of hardcore matches. You just brawl into the back.
All right. Show throws Raven into a storage area and locks the fence door with the referee, but Kane rips the door off. Raven then chokes Kane with a hose. Kane then comes back, and he chokes Raven with the hose and then tosses him through a glass window. This was not the finish. Show puts Kane through a door into a locker room, and then both grab each other's throat, and they end up going through a wall into the room that Raven was thrown into. Raven then takes a golf cart and drives away with Big Show in the back, and they drive into the side fencing area. Kane gets into his own golf cart with Jimmy Corderas in the back seat and nearly runs over Raven's leg as some fan, it's picked up with him yelling, "Fuck him up!" This looked nuts. Like, Raven could have had his, like, leg run over right here. It was very close. They brawl into a food table. Ross notes, there goes the Snapple. They make their way out the entrance, and they're fighting on the stage. Show attempts to press slam Raven off of the staging area, but Kane hits a boot to Show, and both of them go through this side panel onto the floor, and Kane hits a leg drop off of the stage, pins Big Show, and Kane is the new hardcore champion.
Yeah, for a WWE hardcore match, this was good. They really spared no expense with the
walls, golf carts.
They built a whole room. I feel just to toss guys through, and the finish did look impressive with Kane jumping out there.
Visually, I guess it just looked like he didn't even hit anybody upon landing.
Yeah,
but big finish with Kane jumping off a ramp. They go to Kurt Angle backstage, who's rewatching Benoit putting him in the crossface as Edge and Christian walk in. Angle ignores them, and he just is in his own world, saying that if you tap and it's not a match with no referee, then they never officially made anyone tap. And he continues to rewind and watch as Edge and Christian just leave. They show Jimmy Snuka at WWF New York posing on a table. And Jonathan Coachman is then with a fan, Linda, who has traveled to WrestleMania all the way from Brisbane, Australia, and it's her first WWF event ever, and she says it's better than what she expected. It says WWF rules. And then there's an Aussie, Aussie, Aussie chant from the people, I guess, that accompanied her. Mm-hmm. The Rock arrives 40 minutes into the show. Mixed reaction. Very noticeable, the boos, though. He hangs up his jacket and his WWF title, and he leaves.
Yep.
Maybe to get a coffee. Up next, the European title defended by Test against Eddie Guerrero, who is accompanied by Perry Saturn, who was wearing this fuzzy hat.
Yeah.
That was his gimmick. Saturn was also sporting a Lugs t-shirt. Remember Lugs?
Wow. I wonder why. I guess they were a sponsor.
They were a sponsor at the time.
But I've never seen talent wear a shirt.
Like there's no Snickers Cruncher exactly. Shirts here. They should have given Perry a chocolate bar.
Yeah. Or an Oxy pad.
Yes.
Shirt.
Eddie was the referee for a non-title match between Test and X-Pac on Raw that they show highlights of, with Albert giving a Baldo bomb to Test. And then X-Pac gets the win with Eddie stopping Corderas from counting Test.
Anyway.
This was very, I don't know. It's like, why would Eddie even care who wins a non-title match? Somehow this led to a match. So anyway, Test, our first Scott Putski candidate of the night, coming out here ripped. And the match begins with a body press and a power bomb right away from Test as they fight to the floor. Heyman discusses that it would add so much class to have a Mexican as the European champion. Guerrero then attempts to stop Test on the turnbuckle, but Test blocks a Hurricane Rana and hits a reverse elbow off the second rope to Guerrero. Test goes over the top rope, and his leg gets caught in the rope with his left leg.
Like a guillotine spot. You know, like in Shawn Michaels, in his ladder match with Razor.
Yes.
Yeah. But this was unintentional.
Yes. Test was stuck there. Guerrero climbs to the floor, but as he's doing so, falls and spills onto the apron.
Mm.
And the crowd noticeably boos this as Eddie just stumbles. And then Eddie attacks Test to kill time because the referee cannot get Test foot free.
Mm-hmm.
Guerrero then has to help the ref to get Test free.
Yeah.
And people cheer when Test is finally free. And Guerrero works on the right ankle on the floor of Test. We see a sleeper spot by Guerrero. Test hits an Irish whip and then a tilt-a-whirl to Guerrero. Then Test hits a tilt-a-whirl into a powerbomb for a two count. Guerrero comes back with a low blow while Test is going for a full Nelson. And the ref is distracted as Saturn comes in to hit his finish, which is called the
Moss-covered
family credenza, or some variation.
Three-handled family credenza.
Yes.
Yes.
Surprisingly, that name never got over.
Wasn't that name taken from Jericho's promo? Or is that just a name that the boys
I use? Think he just took a bunch of different terms. But yeah, the family credenza is some kind of wrestling hold.
Okay.
Anyway, he put all these names together to think it'd be so clever.
Well, no, I think it's been used before. Like Jericho mentioned it in his 1,004 moves promo. But anyway, his interference looked terrible. It was right in ref was out of position for it.
So Guerrero then gets a near fall, and then he hits a follow-up brainbuster. But Test moves as Eddie comes off the top, and then Test comes back with a pump handle slam. But Saturn then gets onto the apron. He's stopped by Test. Test then goes to the pin, gets a two count. Saturn runs in again, takes a big boot, then a big boot to Eddie. And then all of a sudden, Dean Malenko runs out and pulls Test off of Guerrero. Test hits Malenko while he's on the apron, but the ref is distracted with Malenko as Guerrero hits Test with a belt shot and gets the win. So Eddie Guerrero is the new European champion.
I was not a fan of this match, no, especially considering the participants.
A lot of overbooking at the finish.
Yeah, Eddie did look off, like he was distracted. The Test's leg getting caught up on the ropes probably didn't help matters, and everyone's timing was just weird here.
So not one of the better WrestleMania matches for Eddie Guerrero. Just kind of very average.
Yeah, yeah. They just all seem kind of off.
Michael Cole is then backstage with Mick Foley and asks if he can be an impartial referee. And Foley is shocked. And he recaps everything Vince has done to him by embarrassing him and firing him and says he's going to call it right down the line in Houston, Texas.
While watching this, I mean, at the time, did you ever think that the interviewer in this segment was going to go on to become the top heel of WrestleMania 10 years later?
Absolutely not.
Isn't that amazing?
It's so weird seeing Michael Cole in this role.
Yeah. with his frosted tips.
Oh, those are the worst. Just horrible. Even for 2001.
And now he's the top heel.
He is. Steve Austin is showing backstage as he arrives and sits down in his locker room. Up next, it's Kurt Angle and Chris Benoit. This was the first time these two would ever have a singles match on pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. Angle comes out looking really, really big. Another Putski candidate, sure. Especially when you compare to now. Granted, yeah. He's 42 now. He says he's not a fan of Texas. Their flag is missing 49 stars and calls them bull riding, beer-drinking Texas yeehaws and tells them to lose the freaking cowboy hats because they aren't 7 years old anymore. Heyman says that he's talking to about Ross, and then Ross comes back and jokes about how can a man wear a hat to broadcast WrestleMania? So they're both basically making fun of each other the baseball cap and the cowboy hat.
Mm-hmm. This match, I remember, featured almost zero build at all.
Was announced on the go-home show.
Yeah, yeah.
Bryan and Sheamus has gotten more bush than these two got that year.
And I think I remember being a little bit disappointed by the lack of build, but as a hardcore fan, as a fan of work rate, as an internet wrestling fan, this was all they needed. All they needed to do was just announce this match between the two best technical wrestlers there. I really have a feeling that they put this match out there for people like you and I that appreciate just work rate.
Yeah, you announced this, and like your hardcore audience was salivating at mm-hmm. this singles match. But I agreed with you. I thought, you know, you do need some kind of story going into this. And they kind of tried to establish that. I mean, they didn't announce the match till 6 days before, but it was going back and forth with the two trying to tap each other out. And at least it was something basic. It mm-hmm. wasn't just completely out of left field.
I wish they would do one of these a year, you know, like just the internet crowd match to make everybody that, you know, like us happy on WrestleMania. Like a Daniel Bryan versus Evan Bourne at Mania.
In a suicidal match.
Ah.
Heyman plays up both guys tapping to the other's submission on Raw that past week and says, this is the most exciting thing for a man with his clothes on.
Huh?
He said, let me redo that. He says, this is the most excited a man can be with his clothes on.
Oh.
So outside of sex, this is the greatest thing for a man. Watching these two wrestle.
Oh, that's weird.
Chain wrestling to start with holds and positions and counters from each guy. Angle scores a takedown during the second sequence of holds. Ross mentions the stampede roots of Benoit while Heyman brings up his work at the New Japan Dojo.
Mm-hmm. You know, like for the time, I don't know if this was that commonplace to see all the chain wrestling at the beginning of a match that they
not for a WWF audience.
Yeah, like they didn't really start doing that until slightly afterwards. But I just remember like right out of the gate with all the ground base work here. It was
this was worked like a Jack Briscoe, Dory Funk Jr. Mm-hmm.
It was
style
very,
of match.
It was very different from what people were expecting.
Yeah, Angle tries to grab hold of the ankle and he gets the leverage to apply it. Then the same for Benoit with the crossface. Benoit then positions himself onto the back of Angle, going for the crossface, but Angle reaches the ropes. Then it happens a second time, and Angle gets to the ropes and then walks on the floor to stall. And basically the story early on is that the wrestler is being out-wrestled by Chris Benoit. Angle comes back in, and again Benoit goes for the crossface. Angle gets the ropes and then takes a cheap shot as the referee is separating them, and then it morphs more into your traditional pro wrestling match with the... Mm-hmm. The heel and babyface established, and he ends up taking Benoit to the floor, rams his head into the announce table, and then the steel steps. Angle beats down Benoit, hits two belly-to-belly suplexes. Ross and Heyman argue over why Ross likes the Briscoe brothers, and Ross gets pissed, saying, "Don't tell me why I like somebody." Then they exchange chops in the corner. Benoit hits a knee to the gut of Angle. Then a superplex by Benoit off the top that Heyman cites as a Dynamite Kid-style suplex. Angle goes into the turnbuckle sternum first and then takes two German suplexes. The third one, Angle counters into the ankle lock, but Benoit reaches the ropes, pulls him out, and Benoit reverses into his own ankle lock, which Angle then kicks the head of Benoit to break. Benoit gets the crossface. Angle is then on top and applies his own crossface, and Benoit gets the rope break. So some great transitions here in this match, and all looking really, really solid, I mm-hmm. thought, and the audience was responding as well. Benoit stops an ankle lock. Angle gets kicked into the ref, and then Benoit gets the crossface on. His Angle taps, but the referee, Jack Doan, is out, and Benoit gets pissed. Angle comes from behind with the Olympic slam while Benoit's checking on the ref. Angle then goes for a moonsault, which Benoit gets his knees up. Benoit hits a diving headbutt, gets a two count. Then Benoit takes a low blow that the referee doesn't see. Benoit comes back with an armbar takeover, but Angle rolls him up and grabs the tights and gets the win. And the announcers made it perfectly clear that this feud was going to continue. Angle wins the first match by cheating, and basically it's a moral victory because Chris Benoit was able to out-wrestle the Olympic gold medalist.
Hmm.
Very, very solid match. This was the first really strong match of the card.
I agree with you. Yes. I mean, I really enjoyed the unique style that both of them did at the beginning of the match compared to everything else on the show.
Yeah, it was about the best adaptation you can do for a pro wrestling style match in terms of trying to make it come across like, I won't say legitimate, because I don't think you would watch this and assume it was a shoot or anything. There's a very different style, but they were trying to work a very...
like a UWFI.
Exactly.
Style.
UWFI would be the best template for this. Michael Cole is with William Regal, basically asks him how he's doing. And they go into his office, and Kamala is on the desk with Kim Chi, who's rubbing the Queen's picture on his belly. And Regal just sold this tremendously. It was like, come up with a segment where Regal can look disgusted. And that's what they did here with Kamala. They plug the gimmick Battle Royal, and Ross is joking about Heyman being in it. And Heyman makes a reference to his old cell phone. There's a video on the WrestleMania pep rally from Fort Hood with Bradshaw, Undertaker, Angle, Trish Stratus, Lita, and Jacqueline. The soldiers embark on a march with a WWF-themed charge, where they're doing a chant. Angle plays the goofy heel throughout this. And then we go to Kevin Kelly backstage with Kurt Angle, who says that you have to respect Benoit. And Angle says the better man won, and he doesn't have to respect anyone. He's the best in the WWF. And then Benoit attacks him from behind, puts the crossface on Angle, and Angle taps as the officials break it up. So this was, as most feuds kind of culminate at WrestleMania, this was like the start of their angle at WrestleMania.
It's true, yeah.
We get a video for Ivory and Chyna, and the build-up for this way saw Chyna at the Royal Rumble do her cartwheel into Ivory, injuring Chyna's neck. Ivory then responded by destroying a cardboard cutout of Chyna. Then Chyna reappeared on Raw, attacks Ivory, strips her, and didn't sell a thing that made you want to see this match.
Well, no, they had the right to censor break Chyna's neck with the spike pile driver in this feud.
Oh, is that what they... because... was that, I didn't even see
Chyna,
that.
Chyna was coming back from a neck injury.
Okay, the neck injury was at the Rumble, where she did her cartwheel back elbow was that, the corner, and she went out.
I wasn't sure where it took place, but yeah. They the right to censor did a spike pile driver onto Chyna.
Okay. Well, at least we did one. Chyna sold something here, other than her own fuck up in a match.
In the lead up to this match, Ross and Heyman inform us that Chyna has signed what they called a whole harmless clause. So it means if she breaks her neck, Ivory is not responsible. And I guess neither is the company.
No, apparently.
She breaks her neck.
They should get everyone to sign these.
Yes. And in exchange, the right to censor has agreed not to interfere. So in exchange for not being held legally accountable for breaking someone's neck, they've agreed not to interfere into this match.
Great.
Yeah.
Chyna comes out and does this weird jog to the ring.
Hmm.
That felt noteworthy to write down. Her odd jog. Ivory freaks out.
Yeah, she prances.
Yeah.
Like prancing.
Ivory freaks out over handing over the title to the official and then hits Chyna with the title to start the match. Chyna is face down as Ivory attacks. Ivory gets on her back and has this weak ground and pound. Chyna then grabs the leg of Ivory and just tosses her. Terribly awkward with a hip toss, a back body drop. Ross jokes calling it the Chyna line. And then a powerbomb by Chyna, but she decides to stop herself with the two count.
Man, that pile driver almost killed Ivory. Like, just folded her.
Chyna was like the heel in this, like going for the three count, but pulls her up at two. Yeah. Then there's a press slam by Chyna, and she just lays on her, like, back first for the win. This match totally sucked.
Well, I mean, the idea here is that she is a wrestler that is capable of defeating men. And so why should she even put up any type of fight for this woman's match? That should be way below her.
Well, that would be great if she was a heel. She was a babyface here who possessed no traits of a babyface.
Well, she's like the ultimate warrior.
She dwarfed the heel. She wouldn't sell for the heel.
Well, but there was no selling to be done here.
Well, then she's in a bad role.
Yeah, maybe.
But she would only do... The only angle that built this up was the RTC laying her out with a pile driver.
Yeah.
The heat's on them more so than Ivory.
Yeah, and I guess I don't know why. Maybe they're...
This was also in China. She didn't want to sell for any of the women.
Yeah.
And it was, like, impossible to deal with this woman if she's cast as a baby face.
This was China as the Ultimate Warrior, and Ivory was Triple H.
Yes, you're right.
It's just like that.
I hated this match. This was the worst match on the show.
But it was so short, you know? Nothing terribly offensive.
Jonathan Coachman is with Jeff Bagwell and Moises Alou. The only Bagwell to appear at a WrestleMania. And the coach asks Alou about coming back from his own injuries, if Austin can do this as well. And then he asked Bagwell if they hit a home run tonight with WrestleMania. I thought Coachman was great. He's a legitimate sports fan, and he dealt with these guys. This was fine.
This was edited off of the tape that I watched.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, I missed it.
It's just a nothing interview, but it was a coach was enthusiastic, and he made the guys really seem like they were into all this.
Cool. What is that? How did he get his nickname, the coach?
His last name's Coachman.
Oh, shit. That's right. Never mind.
Vince is with Lindis.
I thought there was some sports tie-in.
Nope.
I think too much. Sorry.
Vince is with Linda, Stephanie, and Trish backstage. Vince confirms that they doubled Linda's dosage for tonight. Way's favorite angle.
Oh, man.
Cole walks in and asks about Shane buying WCW. And Vince guarantees something shocking is going to happen tonight. Which didn't answer the question. There's a video on Vince wanting a divorce from Linda. They recap the whole feud. Linda being sedated after... Vince had an affair with Trish, and it led to Linda having a nervous breakdown. Shane makes the rescue, attacking Vince on Raw to defend his mother. Vince says he'll never forgive Linda for giving birth to Shane. And then they recap the WCW purchase from this past Monday with Shane slipping in and buying control of the company.
And this was also, of course, the angle which featured Trish Stratus making out with Vince and Trish Stratus eventually being told to bark like a dog.
The memorable angles.
Yeah.
So this feud had been built up for quite some time, and obviously with the McMahons, it got a lot of television time. So we go to the match now. Shane and Vince in a street fight with Mick Foley as the special guest referee. Shane is on the mic, and he first gives out a shout-out to the WCW crew in the press box. The camera is, like, on the floor and tries to find them in the press box and can't. They later finally did show them. And
they brought a camera up there eventually.
This included Johnny Ace in the press box. Lance Storm was there.
Was Johnny Ace working for WCW at the time?
He was an agent for them.
That's how he got it.
He, of all the people in WCW, he probably benefited the most from that.
Sure.
He's the one who's by far the most...
Powerful.
Yeah. Then they introduce Mick Foley, who comes down to the ring. Vince comes down with Stephanie, and Heyman shouts the importance of this, but gets the date wrong, saying April 1st, 2000. But then he corrects himself on getting the year wrong. Not the prettiest of selling by Vince early on in this match. Stephanie gets in to stop Shane and ends up slapping Shane. But Shane comes back, hits a baseball slide to Vince on the floor. Shane then grabs these little boards from the barricade and hits Vince in the head with them, and then beats Vince with them. Ross recaps Vince driving Linda to the nervous breakdown and being overdosed with her medication. They even put her in a hospital at one point, a nursing home.
Okay.
Shane hits a clothesline off the barricade to Vince and then takes a kendo stick to Vince. Shane uses his world-class boxing technique here to knock down Vince on the floor, where he's trying to show off his footwork and his precise striking. It's all Shane to start the match.
Yeah.
Shane then clears the Spanish announce table, hits Vince with a monitor, and then he goes to the top rope but misses an elbow dropped as he goes through the announce table as Stephanie gets Vince out of the way.
Yeah, it looked great. Shane always manages to do these high spots very well.
Trish then wheels Linda down the aisle, and Trish helps Vince up from the ground and then slaps Vince to a huge pop, and then Trish and Stephanie fight. Trish is on top in the ring as they continue to fight, and
they're taken out.
Yeah, the ground and pound here by Trish. It was
this was before Trish was became a worker.
Yes, she was really this was when she was in her beginning stages. Mm-hmm. Foley pulls Stephanie away, takes a slap from Stephanie as the women fight up the aisle and leave. Vince then gets up and snarls at Linda and calls her a bitch, to which Ross is just in disgust that Vince would call Linda a bitch. But Foley ends up stopping Vince from attacking Linda, and then Foley turns his back on Vince and wheels Linda away. So guess what? Vince attacks Foley with two chair shots and puts Linda in the ring. Giant chance of asshole here. The crowd was really into this match, Way. Mm-hmm. And Shane here, I had totally forgotten about him. He has been out for about 6 or 7 minutes from this announce table. And Vince puts Linda in a chair in the corner inside the ring and then tosses multiple garbage cans into the ring along with Shane. And Vince hits a garbage can shot to the head of Shane, tosses it over the top rope, and it lands on the announce table right by Heyman and Ross. Repeatedly beats down Shane, and he's mocking Linda as he's doing this, and Linda's in her comatose state. Vince gets another garbage can, and he holds it above his head with his back towards Linda, and then Linda arises from the wheelchair, and it's the biggest pop thus far on the show.
Yes.
And gives a low blow to Vince, which was a little awkward because Linda was trying to fire up. There was no fire in Linda McMahon, but she tried here, and Vince had to separate his legs at the last second when he remembered the spot. Gives the low blow to Vince, which gets a huge reaction. Foley returns and attacks Vince with punches in the corner and then a running knee. And then Shane debuts the Van Terminator that Heyman probably could not exactly convey what he was thinking watching this spot be performed by Shane McMahon. And Shane gets the win. The WCW crew is cheering in their press box. It would be the only thing they'd be cheering over the next year. And then Shane leaves with Linda. I thought this was, it built up to this huge pop from Linda.
Yeah.
And I thought it was booked really well.
Yes,
I understand the storyline was a little out there, but it all built to this reveal by Linda, and I thought it came across really well for the reveal was
very good, I'll give you that. The crowd popped huge as Linda stood up. The finish was strong. I thought the high spots in this match were strong. And it was an entertaining match.
And they were smart to book this as a street fight. These two were not going to have a angled Benoit contest.
And also smart to put this before the TLC match that was to follow.
Yeah, yep, you're right. Then they show highlights from WWF Access with Kevin Kelly interviewing the Hardys discussing their TLC match. They say they want to leave with the tag titles. It's a 2-year culmination and could be the last time. It won't be.
It won't be.
And Jeff says he's going into this match as if it's his last.
It also won't be.
Well, we might have seen his last match a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
But we haven't.
Much slimmer Hardy boys.
Oh, yeah. Both they were slimmer. 10 years younger here. Yeah. 10 years of less bumps.
Yeah.
Triple H is in the locker room just, like, snarling like an animal.
That's how he breathes.
The Undertaker is then showing shadow boxing in the boiler room somewhere of the Astrodome. And then we get Ross and Heyman hyping up the forthcoming TLC 2, calling it the most dangerous match you will ever see. And Ross states concern for all of the competitors and that they want to raise the bar. And that's what we get next, everyone. The Dudley Boys, the Hardys, and Edge and Christian for the tag titles. It's TLC 2 following up on their match at SummerSlam, which was the first TLC, as well as the ladder match from the year prior at WrestleMania. So much stuff in this match to cover here, Way. We'll just go over some of the high points. The match started off with a big flapjack to Christian by the Dudleys, and then the poetry in motion to the Dudleys by Jeff. The first ladder is brought in by Edge and Christian, who attack both teams with the ladder. Matt is the first one to attempt to climb, but he's cut off by an Edge clothesline. The Hardys hit their splash and leg drop combination off the ladders to Christian. The Dudleys then come back. They hit the what's up spot onto Edge and then call for the tables to bring the tables into the match for the first time. Bubba here grabs Jeff and power bombs him onto Edge, who is laying on a table. And this got a very good reaction. All six are then fighting on the ladders, and Matt and Christian are knocked over. Matt gets crotched on the top rope, but Christian sails all the way over the top rope and just lands on the floor off this ladder. They missed it the first time, but then they showed an overhead shot of Christian landing. That's a brutal bump.
Yeah.
And in comparison to the rest of the stuff on this match, it probably doesn't stand out as much, but that's a hell of a fall, even if there's padding there.
It really is, but like you said, do you remember it at the end of this match?
No, you don't. Spike Dudley then runs down. He delivers the Dudley Dog, or the acid drop, to Edge and then to Christian, where he goes off the turnbuckle and the two of them go through a table on the floor. Mm-hmm. Then Rhino runs down and he attacks Jeff and then Devon with a ladder, spears Bubba, and then spears Matt through a table to assist Edge and Christian. And then finally Lita runs out and pulls Edge down from the ladder.
No. She jerks Edge off the ladder.
She jerks off Edge.
That's JR's famous call. She's jerking Edge off.
I missed that, but I'm glad you caught it. Rhino then tries to press slam her, but Spike comes back with a low blow, and Lita hits a Hurricane Rana to Rhino. Spike then takes a chair and gives a chair shot to the head of Rhino, who then tips a ladder with Edge on it while he's climbing.
Everybody catches their cues perfectly.
Yes, this was like just perfectly timed.
Yeah, great use of the three extra members here.
Yeah, it never seemed like there were too many bodies here because they spaced out the spots really well. Yeah,
and like the pop that Lita had when she ran out, being the only woman to come out, of course, and being a very effective, despite being a woman, it was also really cool. It added a lot to this match.
Lita hits a chair shot, a devastating one, to the head of Spike Dudley, and then she ends up taking a 3D, and then we see chair shots to 3D from Edge and Christian. Jeff then sets up this gigantic ladder on the floor with Rhino and Spike laying on tables below. Hardy hits the Swanton. Then Christian and Devon are on top of the ladder. The ladder's taken out by Matt Hardy, and both are hanging on to the metal circle that holds the titles.
It's just so funny that, you know, you mentioned that Swanton, but like, it just like you mentioned it in almost in passing.
I know.
That's really what it was. But this was the Swanton off of the huge ladder.
You
this
would figure
was like a major spot in
like
itself.
You were building to basically take guys out so that it'd be a process of elimination. You would think that would be it for Jeff, but it wasn't. Right back into this almost right away with Christian and Devon hanging on, and they end up falling down, and you have like three sets of three ladders just basically set up in the ring. Jeff gets on top and he scales across, but he loses his balance and falls down to the apron. And actually in the Hardy's book they talk about this, because they had this big argument during the day, I believe it was Jeff and Edge, about this spot, and Jeff kept telling them no, I can do it. Uh-huh. And they were like, all right, fine. He was being stubborn, and he did it, and he lost his balance.
Yeah, perhaps that spot stands out because it was really the only spot that they missed. And if you look at the entire match and everything that was planned for this match, they hit almost everything like perfectly.
I know,
which is incredible.
It didn't really matter because it was all leading to Jeff climbing over, and he was hanging from the metal holder. And he gets his leg caught into the ladder as Bubba's trying to pull the ladder off, and then Jeff is freed from the ladder. He's hanging in midair, and Edge delivers a spear. A highlight that's been showing for years and years. It's one of those, like the Shawn Michaels splash off the ladder. It's one of those well-remembered moments because of how much it's been replayed.
Mm-hmm. Edge, in that WrestleMania DVD, he mentions that he ended up DDTing himself with this.
Yeah, he almost like knocked himself out here. And Matt and Bubba are then fighting for the titles, and Rhino then tips the ladder over, and both go through these four tables with two stacked on top of another two. Mm-hmm. This was it for Bubba and Matt in this match. This was crazy spot.
Crazy spot that they've done a number of times.
Yes.
But here it was just like I just, it's tough to convey because you're naming all these incredible huge bumps, but they were like one right after the other without even a moment to breathe, you know? That's why this match was so memorable and so exciting. It was because everything was just in succession, one after the other. Once you think you've seen this incredible, memorable spot, you see one right like 2 seconds afterwards.
Yeah, it was just, if you were a wrestling fan with ADD, this is what drew you in, were these matches.
Uh-huh.
And Rhino then is hoisting Christian on his shoulders as Devon's climbing up on the other end, but Rhino's giving the boost to Christian, and he is the first to get up, grabs the titles, and Edge and Christian win yet again in the TLC match. So this was, if you're a fan of these style of matches, this was arguably maybe the best TLC match they put together. I thought it was
I would say so.
On such a big stage, as you mentioned, Wei, they hit just about everything perfectly in a match where there's very, very little margin for error. Everyone killed themselves in this match. And it also, in that same WrestleMania documentary, Edge mentions that they want to raise the bar, and they felt they raised it too high with these style of matches. And they really had to scale back after a while, because the expectation even now of a TLC match or a ladder match, people go back to these as the standard, and it's just you can't be doing these matches all the time, because it's look at as you mentioned, Matt and Jeff Hardy, of how much younger they looked 10 years ago. It's like doing this stuff night in and night out, particularly for Jeff, it's taken its toll on him. It's it's really, really tough to you know, you enjoy these matches, but at the same time, these guys just killed themselves.
That's true. But hey, isn't that what it takes to get notice when you're you know, a part of this roster that's so competitive? I mean, 10 years later, can we not say that these guys cemented their legacies with these matches?
I'm much happier knowing these guys got paid a ton of money for this match, and their payoff was probably fantastic, rather than guys on indie shows doing the same stuff for $30.
Yeah, well, yeah, you know, that is the ripple effect, isn't it?
Don't use up your bump card when no one's watching. We get a highlight package from WWF Access, including some fan who spent $200 for Mick Foley's sock. We also see a brief cameo by Jerry Lynn in a Access match.
Oh, wow.
He was showing...
I didn't even notice that. Well, I was like, who is that guy?
It was the equivalent of a flash frame, everybody. But
Jerry Lynn.
There you go. You're a former ECW champion.
You also got to see, in this video package, a soundbite of Kane talking out of character. Like, I guess they would do this once in a while with Kane, but I always thought it was odd, you know, in the same show where you were trying to portray Kane as this monster, you would show him at Access talking.
They put him in a lot of situations out of character. It's not like The Undertaker, where he's so protected in that sense. But even at this point, I guess Undertaker was really doing the same at this point as the biker.
Yeah, but Kane, I guess I just felt they were trying to keep more.
You also got to see Steve Blackman signing some autographs during this.
Another
Steve
one.
Blackman.
Steve Blackman.
Heyman says he applauds the TLC 2 match, and he's so excited here that Ross comes back and asks, "Why are you yelling?" Howard Finkel's in the ring. He announced a new Astrodome record crowd of 67,925 fans. And then they introduced Gene Okerlund and Bobby Heenan to commentate the next match. It's the Gimmick Battle Royal, which when it was first announced, I was excited about this.
Me too.
I don't know how you cannot... this was a perfect kind of filler match to go from TLC into your big, you know, two big main events.
And also just a great... use
nostalgia.
Of the nostalgia pop.
Back when some of these guys weren't so much like Slaughter's been used so many times in the last few years, but at this point in 2001, you legitimately hadn't seen most of these guys in years.
Especially with the folding of WCW, you had a lot more options now too. And that's why we had calling this match Mean Gene Okerlund and Bobby the Brain Heenan.
Yes, they were brought out. And then they introduced the participants of the Battle Royal. We had the Bushwhackers come out. We just got to see Bushwhacker Luke recently, Wei.
Oh, we did.
Totally forgot he was in this match.
Looked exactly the same.
Duke the Dumpster Drosy, who looked nothing like his character in 95.
No, this was a bald-headed Duke Drosy.
A young Iron Sheik, who was walking down, and Heenan noted that by the time he got to the ring, it would be WrestleMania 38. Earthquake comes down and almost laps Iron Sheik on the way to the ring. The Goon... Doink the Clown.
The Goon walking out on his skates.
Yes. Who actually, Bill Irwin, who was competed in world class here in Texas. So there were a few world class guys here, including Kamala, competed in that that territory. He came down with Harvey Whippleman and Kim Chi. Glad they didn't ask to interview him.
Yes.
The Repo Man. Jim Cornette. I totally forgot Jim Cornette was in this match.
Yeah, and what type of gimmick is Jim Cornette doing in this Gimmick Battle Royal?
He's got tennis racket. That would have been awesome if you had Cornette and Heyman in this match.
Wow.
Nikolai Volkov, Michael Hayes, who made perfect sense in Texas, where the Freebirds arguably had their biggest run of their career. The one-man gang, another Texas guy, not from Texas, but world class. The gobbledygooker, who's key red gobbledygooker.
Yeah.
Fuck, guys, get it right.
It's gobbledy.
Thankfully, they replayed the Survivor Series 1990 debut of the gobbledygooker with Mean Gene Okerlund.
Do you know who played the gooker here?
I always assumed it was Hector Guerrero.
You think they brought him back just for this?
Yeah, he probably got a payday out of
man.
It. Two Guerreros on this show. Maybe Chavo was in that press box, too. Got a bunch of Guerreros
that's right.
here. Tugboat, using the Tugboat gimmick and not Typhoon. Hillbilly Jim, Brother Love, who grew up in Houston. And Sergeant Slaughter. So, not much to this match, Way. The entrances were the highlight.
Yeah, that was it, really.
Yeah, that's all you wanted to do. You just wanted to see these guys and then a quick little battle royal. That's all you needed.
I could honestly do one of these every Mania. I would love to.
You find different guys. Yeah, yeah, switch it up. The Repo Man was eliminated first, and then the Gooker by Tugboat. Earthquake was sent out by Kamala. Jim Cornette actually eliminated Bushwhacker Luke by hitting him with the tennis racket, which is awesome. Slaughter eliminates Volkov. Butch is dumped out by Doink. Kamala then tosses out Doink, and the crowd booed this. Yeah. They were big into Doink.
Mm-hmm.
Kamala then he tosses out One Man Gang. Slaughter eliminates Kamala and Brother Love. Cornette. Sorry.
I can't believe you kept track of
I tried
this.
Here. Hillbilly Jim tossed out Sergeant Slaughter, who is... So it came down to Hillbilly Jim, who was leaning over, and Sheik comes from behind and eliminates Hillbilly Jim for the win by de facto that Iron Sheik could not take a bump over the top rope, and he won. This, to me, when this first happened, I thought this was great. The Iron Sheik wins. And fucking Sergeant Slaughter, they book him to come back in and attack the Sheik with the Cobra Clutch. We got to get Slaughter's heat back. Couldn't just let the Iron Sheik win
here. Maybe they just expected the crowd to be unhappy.
Oh, yes, the foreign heel.
Yeah.
I mean, this man, everyone was...
The 65-year-old
no one was buying any of these as legit heels and shit. That was just like, why did you have to do that after?
Whatever.
No one cared.
Okerlund
and Heenan were great here. They were pretty quiet, actually. They were instructed, basically, to throw out all these cliches, and it was just doing it in this really odd... It was like, the tension is so thick... You can cut it with a knife. It was just get out every 80s cliche possible in this match. And that's what they did. Heenan was fairly quick on his feet. And Okerlund ended saying, it's great to be back in the World Wrestling Federation. And I'm sure Heenan was biting his tongue saying, yeah, it's great to be out of prison.
At one point he calls Okerlund Tony.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think it was on purpose, but it was very funny.
That is funny.
But I like this a lot. I mean, it was like
this
you mentioned
a fun little segment,
a release from the previous match that we just saw, and just fun.
Yeah,
fun.
Exactly.
No reason. Nothing at stake here.
Zero wrong with a gimmick battle royal here. So we then go to the graphic for Triple H and The Undertaker, and Jim Ross states, "This should be an awesome contest. We'll be talking about it for years to come." And then it will be completely forgotten. So they throw to the video. It's built up with Hunter attacking Undertaker backstage. And
Hunter here in this video package, he cut the same promo that he cut for this,
exactly
this coming up
the
one.
Same.
He says, you've beaten everybody, Taker, but you haven't beaten me. Or I've beaten everybody, but I haven't beaten you.
Yes. Hunter chokes him with a chair backstage. The next week, Undertaker is waiting for him backstage with a pipe. But Hunter calls the police to get him arrested.
So a very different build than what we're seeing.
Yeah, there were no police involved.
No limos, no kidnappings.
Stephanie then gets a restraining order against Hunter. So we at least know the template that Angle and Jarrett are following.
No, Stephanie got a restraining order against Taker.
Undertaker, you're right. And then Kane shows up and chases Stephanie away. And then we go, fuck, they better not do this on the go-home for this year's show. Kane is about to press slam Stephanie off of a balcony unless Regal agrees to make a match between Taker and Hunter for WrestleMania. And at one point, Regal won't go for it, so Taker's like, okay, Kane, drop her. He was going to murder Stephanie McMahon if he didn't get this match. So Regal makes the match, and then on the final show, Hunter attacks Undertaker with a sledgehammer, then destroys his motorcycle and throws it off the ramp. Very expensive angle here.
Mm-hmm.
We should note, everybody, that in the week leading up to WrestleMania, Shawn Michaels was supposed to be involved here in some capacity, whether it be as a guest referee.
Isn't that interesting?
It's exactly what was planned for this year, too.
Wow.
But Shawn showed up in, quote, no condition to perform, and unlike one company, that didn't mean, well, we'll send him out anyway. They sent him home like a responsible company would and did not use him, and they were pissed at Shawn Michaels. There was even talk of Ray Lewis at one point being involved to take on Hunter because of a...
The boxer?
No, Ray Lewis, the football player who was charged with murder.
Well, I'm thinking of Sugar Ray Leonard.
Yeah, you're thinking of Ray Leonard. He did make a WrestleMania appearance once in a crowd. So that is how this all led to Undertaker and Triple H... No Shawn Michaels as guest referee.
And I think the match was better off for it. You don't need a guest referee.
No,
again.
You totally didn't need it here. Motorhead is introduced, and they play Triple H's theme as he comes down to the ring.
This was really cool. I mean, the only time I'm really up for a band playing at a WrestleMania or any wrestling event is if they were playing the wrestling entrance theme, and here it was really cool.
Yeah,
really
very, perfect. Very good. I love this.
Except it seemed like Lemmy didn't know the lyrics to the song.
Yeah, he was doing, well, was like it's Lemmy.
Ad-libbing.
A little bit. Let's make a Putski winner here because my candidates were Test, Kurt Angle, and Triple H. Leaning towards Hunter here.
Test or Triple H? No, I wouldn't say Hunter. This was before Hunter, you know, fell in love with his body, before his
He
comeback.
Was still big here. Not to 2002 big. Levels. That comeback when he came back after the quad surgery, he had a new area code.
This was when Hunter was still mobile. I mean...
Yep.
But if you, Angle? That's your...
Angle was incredibly thick here. Like, he was probably 260, and he's now about 200, 210.
Sure. Kurt Angle.
Kurt Angle, then, is the Scott Putski.
Congratulations. Kurt Angle.
You won. It's true.
Somebody notify him.
So we go into Undertaker and Triple H. They fight on the floor to start the match with Hunter going through the replacement wooden table that the Spanish announce team was given. We had to break their table again, which was it was just entertaining because it's like the Ross and Heyman are probably just like laughing to death here. Ross brings up the Taker's 8-0 at WrestleMania.
This was before it was as big of a deal as
no, it was.
Now.
I think this might have been the first year they even brought up that he had a streak at WrestleMania. Mm. It was probably just people that would be into that kind of thing would be aware of it, but they never pushed it on TV before this.
Yeah.
In fact, Taker missed the prior year's WrestleMania due to an injury, so this was his first Mania since 1999.
And since then, he's made every one of them.
You're right. Yeah. It's become a huge, huge part of the show.
Mm-hmm.
It's all Taker offense to start. Then he goes for the old school, but Triple H pulls him off the top rope, and this is when Triple H gets the heat in the match. Hunter shoves referee Mike Chioda, who shoves Hunter back while Hunter is on offense. Hunter then grabs the sledgehammer from the floor, but Chioda takes it away. Hunter goes for the pedigree, but it's countered, and Taker hits a slingshot, and Hunter goes into the referee and takes him out. Undertaker then hits a choke slam. The referee revives himself and gets a two count, and Taker's pissed at this slow count and just elbow drops the referee. Drops an elbow on him.
Yeah.
DQ streaks over. They never said this was a no DQ.
Mm.
Street fight rules. Just fucking, this was such a weird, it was such a heel move. It was like a two count, and he just elbow drops the ref.
Yeah.
Sorry, you fucking got flung into, you flung into me and knocked me down.
Well, the ref was knocked out from this blow, and by the time he
this elbow drop, he sold for an hour after this.
And by the time he came to, he probably forgot about it, so he had no reason to
He had a concussion, and he continued working. Undertaker is then... on the floor and backdrops Hunter into the crowd. Taker follows him and they fight through the audience and into the production area in the crowd with the hard camera and the soundboard. The two climb up the production structure to this elevated area above the crowd. Hunter fights back with a chair. He hits shots to the back, the head, then multiple shots to the leg and shoulder, which, considering the state of Undertaker's shoulder now, not the wisest shots to be taking. Right on the shoulder.
Yeah, they kind of went nuts. I really love the visual here of them fighting on the sky. scaffold in the middle of the crowd, and they would always cut to this wide shot, just like these two men wrestling on this metal, contraption with the huge crowd surrounding them. I thought it looked great.
Hunter goes for another chair shot attempt, but Taker grabs him by the throat and then choke slams him to the floor. And you're assuming he just hit the cement floor. They show a replay where he goes down, and then they show this overhead replay, which totally ruined this for me, because you see him fall on this big crash pad. It's like, sure. Why'd you show that replay?
I thought it came off even worse when they actually went to the close-up from below, where you could see Taker jump off, and you can clearly see the padding. But nonetheless, like, it's not like... I don't mind it at all. Like, I really don't mind it when they do things like this, because I'd rather for the guys... The point of wrestling is to be safe, but have it look, you know, crazy.
Yeah, by no means did this, like, ruin the match. I just thought it was it was an obvious angle that just kind of ruined whatever they were trying to accomplish here. Taker then hits an elbow drop to the floor onto Hunter as the EMTs are checking on Hunter. They go back to the ring. The ref is still out cold from this elbow drop. Taker gets a sledgehammer, but now he ends up taking a low blow from Hunter. Hunter then runs in with the sledgehammer, but takes a big boot. Hunter attempts the tombstone, but it's countered, and Undertaker hits the tombstone, but the referee is still out. Taker goes for the last ride, but Hunter grabs the sledgehammer as he's being lifted up and smashes Taker in the head with the wooden part. The referee comes alive and
No. He smashes Taker with the metal part.
It looks like he flung it vertically and I thought the wooden part hit him in the head.
He just pretty much drove it down on top of Taker.
You didn't really see the contact, the movement.
I absolutely loved that spot. It was just
looked good.
It was like it came out of nowhere too, because you couldn't really see. It wasn't noticeable that Hunter grabbed the sledgehammer from right there, and it just came as a total surprise. And it was executed perfectly.
Looked really good. Mm-hmm. Taker bled from that shot, and then after that, Hunter goes into the corner, gets on the second rope, and he's delivering punches to the Undertaker, but Taker stops it and comes back and hits the last ride out of the corner and gets the win. And Undertaker moves to 9-0 at WrestleMania, and Taker rides his bike out. This was a very, very good match.
And 1-8 for quality of matches with the Undertaker. I couldn't think of a better Undertaker. This was really Taker's first good match at Mania.
We had Snuka, terrible. Jake Roberts.
Kamala.
Not very good. 9 was Giant Gonzalez. 10 he missed. 11 was Kama Mustafa. 12 was Diesel. 13 was Sid, 14 was Kane, and 15 was that Hell in a Cell where he killed the Big Boss Man. Some horrible WrestleMania matches.
Needless to say, like, going into this match, I was not expecting this quality of match from The Undertaker.
Me neither. I mean, at this point, Taker was not exactly...
known for being a great worker.
Unless in with the right guy, and Hunter was awesome at this time. And at this point, like, he had just had the 2000 was a fantastic year for Triple H, probably his best year in ring wise. So Taker gets the win. Then we get an interview with fan Will Borchere for winning some drawing contest. Did you get to see this?
Yeah, I did. A Photoshop contest.
He had to redesign the Limp Bizkit CD cover to incorporate it into WrestleMania. They showed the winning picture, and fuck, I would hate to see the ones that lost, because this sucked.
This was shit.
Ahmad Butt probably vomited looking at this. It was just Austin and Rock's heads put onto these, like, aliens on front of...
On the album cover.
Chocolate, whatever the fuck the CD was called.
It's like he did it in paint. Like, it was the level...
Really bad, and he won fucking seats to WrestleMania. He got to meet all the talent.
This was...
It was horrible.
A joke.
Yeah. Should have been thrown out.
That album cover is terrible, too. It's a terrible album cover, looking album cover, terrible design. Even the font, like the writing on the back of it, just so shitty.
What was the name of it again? The chocolate starfish and the hot dog flavored water? Yeah. What does that even mean?
Well, a chocolate starfish. Do you not know?
No, I don't really know. Explain it to me. Is it some sexual term?
I'll tell you afterwards.
I want to know now. Because people are going to laugh at me already on the wall. I don't know what a chocolate starfish is.
Well, A chocolate starfish is what the kids call... A
turd?
No. An asshole. If you look at the sphincter, it looks like a starfish.
That's so lame.
And
so what?
Chocolate, because of shit.
And then the hot dog flavored water is what, piss?
Hot something dog with your dick? Flavored water. You know, I actually looked this up.
Oh, of course you did.
I did look this up, and I think that was just like an inside joke between Wes Borland and Fred Durst.
I thought the inside joke was this album, because I've heard the album.
You have? I have not done that.
This is probably actually their best album. They had, what was on this besides My Way? They Rolling. Had Rolling was on this. Break Stuff.
Yeah. No. Break Stuff wasn't. Rolling and they had My Generation.
Oh, yeah. My Generation. Horrible band in hindsight. What a mistake.
I liked them for like a six-month period. Everybody did. The whole world did. And then.
This was their peak. And then 2 years later, they performed live.
Yes.
I can't believe they didn't get them for this show. They should have made that push.
Maybe they made the call that it was too much.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they could have performed Taker's Entrance as well.
You're right. Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
But I guess...
No, that would have been a cool visual if you had Motorhead on one side and Limp Bizkit on the other side.
That would have been awesome. I thought about that.
I think that would be cool. I wonder if they would... If bands always have egos about shit. I wonder if they would...
Maybe they ran out of budget.
Oh, come on. Their budget was fucking unlimited here.
I don't know.
They just spent $2.5 million in their back pocket for WCW.
Maybe they actually made the call that, and they said, you know, maybe one band is enough. But they certainly...
I think that would have been really cool to have opposing bands for the Hunter Undertaker match.
It would have been wicked. It would have been awesome. I mean, compared to this, the year right afterwards, they had two bands. They had Drowning Pool and Saliva.
Yeah, you're right.
Which was, to me, was overkill.
Forgettable.
There were like four musical performances at the next year's WrestleMania.
Yeah. So that takes us, everyone, to the main event of WrestleMania 17. They show The Rock walking backstage to the ring. Austin's shown in his locker room as he gets up to head to the gorilla position. Ross and Heyman emphasize that both need to win this match and cannot afford to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And then they play the greatest hype video in WWE history, the My Way video.
Man, like, watching it again, there's really nothing technically incredible or spectacular in terms of effects about this video at all.
It tells a really good story.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, I think just the mood and the feeling of it was really well put together. And the song, say what you want about Limp Bizkit, this song worked perfectly.
Oh, it was great.
It fit great.
Just where they hit the sequence where they're staring at each other into the punch. Awesome. Just so good. Mm-hmm. This was a great period for the crew where they would put together sequences with like popular music. And it led to all the Desire videos that I thought some of those were really, really well done.
It's too bad we can't really review any of those because like those I just remember being so great.
They were pumping those out like one a week for a time period. Like the first time I saw that, I was just like, fuck, is this amazing?
They did them and like I just felt like, you know, like they reminded me why I enjoyed this ridiculous soap opera thing.
Because Linda McMahon did not remind you of that and her sedation. All right, Rock and Steve Austin. Quickly to recap the angle going into this. I mean, you had Rock and Steve Austin, the two biggest draws of the boom period, facing each other at WrestleMania. That was basically enough. They threw in Deborah here as The Rock's manager, that Vince ordered her to manage Rock.
Which was really...
stupid.
Yeah.
It's just a way to, okay, let's not... We need something to get us through 4 weeks of TV and some mini storyline. And at the end, they got rid of Deborah, so her presence was not seen at all at WrestleMania.
Because she was originally supposed to, she was supposed to accompany The Rock here in this match.
I always thought that Steve Austin should never...
Be married.
Like, he should not be married. His character should not be married.
Like what you said about Randy Orton
this past week. It's like people don't understand that stuff. They'll come back and go, well, Austin's a real person. Real people get married. You don't understand characters.
He doesn't fall in love. He has no feelings.
You don't want to see this guy and that side of him. You just don't need that.
What is this badass doing with this bimbo?
Ugh. Like, imagine Steve Austin coming out in this entrance with Deborah walking with him.
Yeah.
Oh, Austin, I would have vomited.
Steve Austin fucks girls and leaves them behind.
That's not what we said. That's what Way is saying.
Well, that should be what the character is.
All right. Let's get into the match. You and I would have ruined this WrestleMania. All right. They announce, Finkel announces it's a no DQ match, and Ross asks, when was that added? Mixed reaction for The Rock comes out and half boos, half cheers. Austin was treated like Jesus coming back to life, which in Texas was...
No, he might as well have been.
He really was here, which is a very noteworthy reaction, everybody, for what would happen later. Austin and Rock go for stunners early. They started off like 100 miles an hour here, just like getting the crowd right away and then slowing things down.
I don't know if that was a design or if it was because of the time issue. Was there a time issue at the end of this?
They had 45 minutes out here, so it was. I don't think time was a problem at all here.
But it worked very well. Like, Austin, with so much energy right off the bat, it just really conveyed how much he wanted to win.
Yeah, I thought it was a good way. These two starting with, like, a collar and elbow tie-up, I don't think it really would have grabbed people. Rock is tossed to the floor, then they brawl into the crowd. Austin hits a superplex to Rock for a two count and then takes the turnbuckle pad off. Rock makes a comeback, and the fans turn on Rock here during his comeback. They fight to the outside. Austin hits Rock with the ring bell, and it busts open the Rock. And then Rock climbs onto the announce table by himself, and the table collapses. That's why we had to leave. That's why we had to break two Spanish announce tables, because Rock was going to stumble onto an announce table. I don't think it was booked to break.
No, he was laying on top of the table, and the table just gave way. Yeah.
Rock makes another comeback with a running forearm and gets booed, runs Austin into the exposed turnbuckle, and then he gets the ring bell and brings it inside the ring, hits Austin, and it busts open Steve Austin and leads to a two count by The Rock. They fight again on the floor. Rock ends up getting the sharpshooter on into the ring with Austin's face all bloody, basically back to 97 with the infamous sharpshooter spot.
Yeah, which JR calls out.
Rock then pulls him back into the middle of the ring as Austin tries to reach the ropes.
But why, if there's no DQ, why are there rope breaks?
Good point. Very good point. Austin comes back and applies his own sharpshooter, but Rock breaks out of it. Austin is then working on the knee and applies another sharpshooter, but Rock reaches the ropes to more boos. And then Austin whips out the million-dollar dream with the announcers bringing up that he hasn't used that move in years. And Rock ends up, he keeps his arm up on the third try when the referee is seeing if he's out. And then Rock does the counter that Brett did at the 96 Survivor Series where he basically lunged off the turnbuckle and flipped over. And that got a near fall.
Done very well.
Yeah, the crowd was just going nuts at this point.
And I loved, like, to me, I don't know if this was intentional or not, but the use of this move signaled a bit of a heel turn, because this is a very, very much a heel move, and especially for Steve Austin, who didn't use this since his heel run.
Yeah, it was at this part of the match, you could see the subtle heel tendencies of Austin here.
Yep, just willing to do anything to win, including using the ring bell and using
It just slowly escalated. Like, he tried to beat him with certain moves, it wouldn't work. He got more frustrated, and then he continued to go more of a heel throughout the match. And it was at this point that Vince McMahon came down to ringside. Both men trade spine busters. Rock then goes for the people's elbow. He hits it, but McMahon pulls Rock off of Austin to break the count. The announcers are confused, and they ask why Vince did that, as Rock stares at Vince and then chases after him, runs back into the ring right into a rock bottom by Austin, and Austin gets a two count. Rock blocks a stunner, and Austin lightly runs into Earl Hebner, who takes a bump to the floor. Austin then hits a low blow to the Rock. He asks for a chair from McMahon, who helps him, and they work together to deliver a chair shot to Rock. They hit him in the face with a chair. Rock gets his hand up. Austin then has the visionary fall, but Hebner is out cold. Vince revives Hebner, and Rock kicks out to a giant pop. Austin is pissed and yells, "Shit! Shit!" Austin then hits a chair. He gets the chair, but Rock comes back with a rock bottom as McMahon distracts Hebner. Rock brings McMahon in and punches him in the corner, and then walks into a stunner from Austin with the big exaggerated Rock sell to the stunner. Yeah. But again, Rock kicks out. This crowd was like on the edge of their seats here for these near falls.
Yeah.
Austin with another chair shot to Rock and another kick out. Then a chair shot to the ribs of the Rock, and then Austin repeatedly hits him in the back and the leg, just like tons of chair shots
here. He goes nuts with the chair. It was like a man trying to squash a bug.
Yes. And gets the win after 8,000 chair shots.
It's a very interesting finish. You know, like it wasn't a sequence of moves or anything. It was just a man going nuts. Like, he's tried everything. Now he's just going to do the simplest thing possible. And that's just continually, desperately, you know, try to put this guy out with this chair.
It's like he hit special and he just continued to power up to special multiple times and just killed this guy. Okay. All right. After the match, Austin and McMahon shake hands. Ross just sells this huge. Heyman says that Austin has sold his soul for the WWF title. Both have a beer together as Ross calls him a son of a bitch, being in the hospital after his neck surgery. And then Austin with another belt shot to The Rock after the match. And the show ends with Ross yelling that things will never be the same with this dazed look as Rock is trying to regain consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I give them 100% on trying to get Austin over as a heel here. Like, yeah. They had to work their ass off to get this Texas crowd to boo him.
Oh,
they did not want to boo this guy. It was like this crowd was dragged kicking and screaming to Austin turning heel.
Even at the finish, by the time Austin got the pinfall, you could hear a large portion of the audience cheer for it because that's how much they wanted Austin to win.
This match, I thought, was fantastic. Yeah. I thought it was really well done.
I liked it better than their WrestleMania 19 match.
I did too. I thought this was the high end of the Rock Austin series. The fact that they were coming in after these fans had watched 3.5 hours of wrestling and really solid wrestling.
Yeah.
Like, look at the TLC match, Angle Benoit, the Shane Vince. I mean, this was not
Hunter,
just
Taker.
Hunter and Taker. Yeah. I mean, this was an incredible show to follow at the end with a main event and going out there for a half hour.
And it's really a testament to the strength of this card and also the pacing of like the lineup of the matches where you built up to the most anticipated matches from the bottom. And yeah, just a very good, very good lineup.
Fantastic show. I give the show 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
I mean, this was the first show to hit 1 million buys. It was the peak of the Attitude Era.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people would say the end of the boom period.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were never at this level again after this. And there were a lot of, looking at the booking of this way, I mean, I just, you're turning Austin, but they didn't have a baby face ready to challenge him.
The Rock was leaving after this.
The belief was Hunter would turn baby face, and instead he stayed heel and joined up with Austin, and your only baby faces were Undertaker and Kane, who are fine as you know, top-end guys, but not the top guys.
Yeah.
And Benoit and Jericho, they tried to turn months later and make them the top guys. That really didn't click.
Mm-hmm.
Benoit was then taken out. You kept Angle as a heel. There was no baby face ready for him.
Yep.
And I didn't really necessarily, like, yes, Austin had been a solid top-end guy for, you know, from 97 onwards at this point. But the crowd was not sick of this guy.
Mm.
If Rock was leaving here till the summer to go do a movie,
Scorpion King,
it was like, why wouldn't you turn him heel or have him come back as the heel, coming back from Hollywood for a feud with Austin as the babyface?
So, yeah, I don't know. Because
it would be very hard to turn Rock here in this match,
yeah,
and Austin wins. But yeah. I just thought it just lacked some foresight here, and Austin himself has regretted this heel turn. He wanted to do it personally to challenge himself as a heel, but for business, they wanted Austin as a heel.
In recent interviews, I've heard Austin mention that if he had it his way, if he knew what the future was gonna, show, he would have just called the audible to stun McMahon right there in the middle of the ring at the end.
That, I thought, was the biggest problem of the execution of this. It's one thing to turn Austin. It's another to have him align with Vince McMahon. And we go back to the character of Austin. I mean, fans got into wrestling based on that feud.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like you pretty much told them, well, it's bullshit. These two are together now.
Yeah,
I mean, that was the feud people really sunk their teeth into.
You wasted my time.
Yeah, I was like, I invested so much into this feud, and now Austin is with this guy.
Mm.
It's just, I thought that was a mistake too, and it was just, Austin is the chicken shit heel, which is how he came out of this with, where he was crying at times,
and then doing
it just
all the
didn't
comedy
fit him at all. And Austin, as he never, hit that level again as a babyface. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was still very popular when they turned him, but never at the level he was 98 to 2001.
Yeah. Now, with all that said, I mean, we look at a John Cena right now, everybody, a lot of people clamoring for a John Cena heel turn. Do you think it would be a right time, knowing, you know, seeing what had happened with Austin way back then, to turn John Cena heel?
I think for the short term, it would really revitalize things because it's so different. I mean, he has been the babyface. But I do question if, look how much this merchandise this guy sells and how many kids have gotten into wrestling because of John Cena. Mm-hmm. That to turn him, you don't have that next babyface.
Yeah.
Randy Orton is not that guy.
Nope.
And you don't have a guy that can fill in. And that's a testament to Cena. I mean, he is a babyface at a level none of the other guys are. And mm-hmm. I really believe this feud has actually hurt Cena with Miz and Rock.
Yeah.
I think he's come off a lot. He's come across as this secondary star to The Rock,
mm-hmm.
who's bombed on an interview. And I think Cena, they do need to rehab him after WrestleMania.
Hmm.
So if it was my call, I wouldn't be turning Cena heel.
No, I don't think
unless
I would
have the right guy ready. And I don't see anybody on the roster that's ready
well,
for
who's next in line after Cena? There's Orton and then Jerry Lawler.
Yeah.
There really is nobody. You're right. And I think that is something that people often overlook when they say how much John Cena needs a heel turn.
Yeah. I think it's sure, it'd be cool to see Cena turn, but I mean, okay, where is this company going to be in 6 months mm-hmm. when the interest of just seeing Cena cut a heel promo is gone?
Yeah.
And it's okay, we have a heel now mm-hmm. that is not going to draw as much as the babyface version.
Yeah.
And you have a fan base that doesn't have that top guy. It'd be like turning Hogan in the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah.
So but that was WrestleMania. What do you give that show?
I do also give this a 10 out of 10. I think I would only be hesitant slightly because my memory of the show is so great that I think I went in with this viewing with expectations that were too high. But, I mean, just talking about it right now, how can I say anything really bad about this show?
I will say, watching this, I'd always believe 17 was my favorite WrestleMania just because of the timing that it came at. It symbolized mm-hmm. the peak of the wrestling period for me. That being said, I think 19 is an extremely underrated show.
Mm-hmm.
That was a phenomenal show.
That was a good show.
In ring wise, I think it's right at the level of 17. I think I gave 19 like a 9 out of 10, but it was when the company was so much further down and was during.
But I would still rank this one higher because you had that TLC match, which is an absolute classic. Hunter and Taker, to me, is a classic. And Rock Austin, the best one of the two that they've ever had.
So.
And Angle, Benoit, and everything else. So.
And sandwiched in between these two manias that we debate on which one was better, we got the shit version in Toronto.
Oh,
which,
man.
That, to me, was another reason about 18, was that it was coming off of 17.
Yeah.
When the roster was so stacked, and it's like, we're really getting Austin and Scott Hall on this show.
Oh, I know. I was personally so disappointed.
Like, it was great to see Rock and Hogan live.
Yeah.
I don't think I would have enjoyed it as much if I watched it at home. Being there live was fantastic. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, in terms of just in-ring stuff, it was like, fuck, we're getting Angle and Kane.
Yeah.
Benoit's injured.
Taker versus 50-year-old Flair.
Yeah. And then Jericho and Hunter, the crowd was out of it for that. It was such a letdown because, you know, WWE by themselves had put the expectations so high. Coming off a show like that, and it's like the talent was there in 2002. It's not like we had a weak roster.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right.
So that was WrestleMania 17, everybody. 10 years ago that took place. And we have a couple of chats we want to get to. The first, we spoke about Steve Austin there, and we have aired this in the past, but I did want to get to the comments in case some of you have not heard our Austin interview. Here are his comments about the heel turn in 2001 and his thoughts on the turn.
Now, going back to 2001, really the peak really was the big WrestleMania, the Astrodome show. Hindsight being 2020, do you regret the heel turn?
Well, you know what? Here's the deal. I mean, and I love that match. It's one of my favorite matches.
Oh, yeah.
One of my
favorite matches
is with Bret Hart and WrestleMania 13 in Chicago Rosemount. And that was probably – those two are my favorite matches. When I wrestled The Rock – And Jesus Christ, man, we went in there, and that place, of course, I grew up 100 miles from there, so I was hands down, you know, more popular in that match. Rock was extremely hot, and I love working with a guy. We've always loved working with each other because I bring out the best in him and vice versa. And do I regret it? Man, I tell you what, the feeling was so energetic and the adrenaline was so high, and it was my idea to switch heel because I was feeling like I was starting to plateau. I didn't really have anybody I really wanted to work with at that time. Oh, lots of people, but I wanted to do it in a different way because I've always enjoyed being a heel.
Yeah.
But it just turns out when I started getting hot, I turned into a babyface. So I just thought it'd be cool, and Vince always likes to do something real big, you know, or unexpected at a WrestleMania. So I wanted to turn heel. Right then, when I you know what, when I beat The Rock, when I hit him with all those super stiff chair shots,
yeah,
that didn't turn me heel. I mean, it was just a crazy match. Anything went, you know. And but it was the fact of, you know, when I shook Mr. McMahon's hand, Vince, and then you know, we kind of did the deal. And the next night in Fort Worth, beat The Rock up again, and Hunter came down. Looking back, right there in the ring, I should have just looked at Vince and said, hey, Vince, we're calling it off. I'm going to stay just like this. And we could have done that. But we didn't because, you know, we had shook hands and that was going to be the deal. So it wasn't the best business move in the world. And, you know, when I switched back to babyface, I hate to say that, you know, switching back. But, you know, I was able to get right back to where I was. But that wasn't a good call, no.
So from Steve Austin way, we are now going to transition over to a guy who was working with the company at the time in a variety of different capacities, that being Kevin Kelly, who is now a current announcer for the Ring of Honor internet pay-per-views on Go Fight Live, as well as Lucha Libre USA. And Kelly was fully involved with this show and a lot of the talent he was involved with in developmental as well and watching them progress up to the main roster. So we are now going to go to that live interview with Kevin Kelly right now. Looking back at that infamous WrestleMania from the Astrodome, many would say the greatest WrestleMania of all time, and you were very much involved with the company at that point. Do you kind of look at that as really the high point of that boom period? Because it seemed that everything from the prior 3 years, it really culminated on that one night with just a gigantically successful event.
And you're exactly right, John. And then 48 hours later, the numbers 1 and 2 stars in the industry were changed forever because The Rock left to go do movies, and Stone Cold Steve Austin turned on the fans and was now completely different. So the fans, what did they have to grab onto? Nothing. And in that void, it has taken, we're still now, 10 years removed from that, and Cena has only partially filled that void. Others attempted to fill that void, but never quite got to that level. And I don't know if it's a period we will ever see again. But that was the end of a tremendous era, the biggest drawing era in wrestling history.
Kevin, let's take a step back, and we know you as a commentator, as a host of Bite This from that era, but obviously if you work in that company, you wear a lot of different hats. So can you just tell us, tell the audience what your duties were with the company at the time?
Well, at that time, I think I was doing a lot of work in talent development. I was working with the Ohio Valley Wrestling Group. At that time, we had 4 talent development areas. We had Memphis, we had Louisville, we had Los Angeles, and then we had Puerto Rico for a while, and then became Cincinnati. So there was change in flux. So overseeing the talent that was in those 4 different areas, assisting Jim Ross wherever possible, assisting the actual managers, the boots on the ground that were running those different promotions, from Jim Cornette and Danny Davis in OVW, who I didn't need to do much for, to Terry Golden in Memphis, who needed a lot of assistance because he really didn't have a lot of other help. So it was a lot of no 2 days were the same, and it was great to see a lot of great young talent come up through the ranks.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about your recall of the events leading up to that WrestleMania 17 week, beginning with the announcement of the purchase of WCW?
It was, I wrote about it this week in a column that's on WrestleZone.com. It's so fresh in my memory because we were at the Gund Arena, And Vince, we started the production meeting, and he basically said, this is almost an exact quote, he said, well, you're going to hear about this later today, but we wanted to let everybody know that we bought WCW. And there was a pause, and there was kind of a snicker. Wow. He sat back in his chair, knew, and the rest of us that were completely caught guard thought it was a... He laughed because it sounded so funny, and he goes, it's true.
Wow.
And kind of went into the details of what happened and proudly told everybody that he bought the whole company for $2 million. And you started doing the math in your head, and you're like, my gosh, we own everything for $2 million, including the tape library? Holy cow. This is the biggest purchase ever. This is like, you know, the English buying Manhattan Island for beads. I don't know whether it was because WCW was so down in their luck or Vince really got over on them, but this purchase was a huge steal. and I think shaped the future of the company, because eventually they're going to get to this 24-hour network, and programming is crucial to that. So, that was an amazing time. And then we got to the building for WrestleMania that day, and we knew that a lot of WCW talent was going to be there. We had seen some of them. And as we got to the building, we didn't know who we were going to see. We had an idea of some. We knew where they were going to sit. But everybody was kind of on high alert. And they kind of kept everybody separate, if I remember correctly, that day. And then there was some shots of the guy sitting in the skybox. And within, you know, short order, we had... the invasion angle and everything fell apart.
Yeah, well, it started off, I mean, with so much promise. I mean, this was, for a lot of fans at the time watching, it's like, here's the company going into what is going to be their most successful show financially in history. And then coming out of it, we have potentially the biggest storyline in wrestling history that they've been clamoring for. And it seemed like just such a, this is a layup for the company that they're just going to be printing money coming out of this show.
It looked as if, because again, we knew the transition was going to happen with Austin and Rock, that this would be something to perhaps buoy in the interim. They were, again, this was going to be two completely separate brands. This was two completely separate companies operating under one roof, running separate live events, separate television, separate everything. But none of that came to be. And I think the television, of course, the main driving factor for so much in wrestling today, I wasn't privy to any of the negotiations, but I don't think that Vince was able to secure a good time clearance for a WCW program, because the brand had been so beaten down that they decided to kind of fold it all in under the one umbrella. But, it started off with a lot of promise and then frittered away. The other side of the coin is, if you look at what Vince did, excuse me, when he bought up all the talent out of the territories, he basically buried all of them or changed their gimmicks in some way. So some would say that, you know, the handwriting was on the wall for Vince to bring these guys into the fold and ultimately squash most of them or crush most of them underneath the weight of the, because nobody was going to be bigger than the brand. You know, nobody came into the WWF then and was bigger than the WWF guys. I mean, look what they did to Harley Race and Dusty Rhodes, great NWA stars. Ric Flair was the only one who ever got over as he was, and everybody else needed to be repackaged for some unknown reason.
Yeah, and that was always one of the criticisms, was that fans were wondering, you know, where are the Goldbergs and the Hogans? And I remember speaking to Jim Ross about this about a year ago in an interview, and he brought up a really good point, was that to bring those guys in, you're basically going to upset the entire locker room just bringing in these giant contracts for guys, and that it would have created, like, here is this WWE locker room that has got you to this point, and all of a sudden you're bringing in all of this outside talent that's going to completely throw that out structure-wise with these big contracts.
Any time that outside talent came in, and a prime example of that was Mark Mero. Mark Mero and Sable came in together to meet with Vince, and this was one of the few contract negotiations that Vince handled on his own. Vince was completely enamored with Sable from the minute he met her and signed Mark Mero to, I believe, a guarantee of $350 a year,
mm-hmm.
which at the time, he was making more than The Undertaker.
Wow.
So Mark Mero and of course, the boys being the boys, we all find out what he's getting paid. Everybody's upset about it. it was so that type of balance was one of Jim Ross's great skills. The ability to soothe everyone else while at the same time doing the things that Vince wanted you to do from a creative standpoint, and making sure that the contracts fit within the giant lexicon of all of the personalities, these, you know, intricate egos, fragile at times, knowing when to stroke them, knowing when to be tough. That was one of Jim Ross's great, great skills.
Kevin, let's talk about the actual WrestleMania 17 event itself. Upon walking into that massive, massive stadium with that beautiful set, what were your thoughts just about the way things looked? And, you know, because the company hadn't done a stadium show since WrestleMania 7 many years back.
It was the first time, other than we had done a Sky Dome, and I think either it was before or after we had done a Georgia Dome, but nothing to the scope of this.
Yeah.
It was the first time we had ever seen the truck inside the building, the production truck.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a scene where, I'll never forget, where a few of the production assistants and the producers, a couple of the girls that worked inside and helped do pre-tapes and things like that, they came outside from the truck, and they stood down on the floor, and they looked at all the people, and they were just... they were awestruck. They were like holding hands like, oh my gosh, I can't believe we're part of something so massive. As a company and as individuals working for that company, we were really taken aback at how many people were there that day. I stood on the floor. I tell this story all the time because it goes part parcel with my beliefs. I stood on the floor with Russ and Charlie Haas, who were in developmental at the time. And we talked about goal setting. And at the time, they were in developmental in Memphis. And said, okay, boys, let's set a goal from here. What do we want to do? Well, we want to get to WrestleMania. I said, okay, then let's set a goal to make it our, you know, make it the plan to be at WrestleMania 1 year from now. And that was the plan they had going forward. Well, that following December, Russ tragically passed away. And then Charlie was derailed by a knee injury. And so that WrestleMania dream was put on hold for a while, but it came 2 years later, where Charlie was able to finally make it to WrestleMania in Seattle. And that type of goal setting is very important. Visualization, put a date on it, and then work towards that goal. And with the guys that day.
Being as involved as you were in the talent development, Kevin, I mean, there also had to have been a big source of pride for yourself, for Jim Ross, the entire crew there that assembled this team together, because not only was this the most financially successful WrestleMania, but you look up and down. I mean, you'd be hard pressed to find a WWE card that delivered as much in the ring. I mean, this was just a phenomenal show from top to bottom, especially from the top end of the card. I mean, the WWF during that time period, they really established their main events at a certain level that you had to hang at,
and that was a and that I think was one of the high water marks from that era. There were some times through the Attitude Era where the talent was a little bit thin, but then the acquisitions as they came along and the development up through the ranks of the stars like Edge and Christian and the Hardys, and bringing in Benoit and Kurt Angle. And those guys being able to come in and develop and produce at such a high level really volumes about where the company was at this time. History-making moments, you know, great visuals that we will never forget as fans. You know, my favorite match that night was Benoit and Angle, but Rock and Austin was great. Didn't have to look and Undertaker on that card as well?
Mm-hmm. Hunter and Taker, yes.
Which we're not supposed to remember anymore, Kevin.
I'd forgotten that. I'm sorry. What were we talking about? But,
exactly.
You know, one of those, that was one of those truly, you know, there wasn't anybody who was rushed, who was in those spots. And everybody that was there deserved to be there. And it really was the best of the best going at it.
You talk about the great visuals that everybody remembers from that show, and a match that provided many of those great moments was the TLC 2 match. You know, as somebody who has a personal relationship with a lot of the participants of that match, were you very concerned while watching it, knowing that these guys had to outdo however much they've already done?
that the concern is the first feeling that I had any time the guys were put in a risk match. Jeff Hardy severely bruised both of his heels in that match, coming down off the ladder. There was, you know, you watch that match backstage and your heart's in your throat the whole time. It was, it's scary at times to watch that, but you marvel at the, you know, and you just pray that they continue to get up. And every subsequent dangerous match that I've ever seen, whether it's a, you know, Money in the Bank match or anything, anytime there's risk involved, you know, you watch it with great concern because you care about these men, you care about these women, you care about who they are as people. They have families, they have kids, and they're giving it their all just because they want to perform at WrestleMania. They want to make history. They want to steal the show. They want to be the guy who was remembered for that one magical moment at WrestleMania, because this is the one show that everybody watches. The casual fan, the hardcore fan, everybody will gather, whether it's in a bar, whether it's in homes or by themselves. And then, of course, you know, it lives now through the internet. We see it time and time again. But that's the risk element. Any show you have like that, very dangerous matches, always watched with one eye closed.
And as we finish up, Kevin, I just wanted to get some of your thoughts. We mentioned it a bit off the top there with, of course, the major angle to close the show with Austin turning heel. Really a turning point for the company at that point. A lot of fans had got into pro wrestling at that time period through that Austin-Vince McMahon feud. When you first heard about this idea of turning Austin, I mean, what was the general reaction of the company? Was it simply trying to refresh something? Because I didn't see a big clamoring at that time to turn Austin at the time, and it seemed that, and you didn't have that top and babyface ready to be kind of his foil on the other end.
I don't know, and I think the plan originally was for him to turn the year before.
Uh-huh.
But injury had precluded that from happening. So as we get to the Astrodome, we knew that there was going to be a void. The void was really felt the following night after the cage match, when you realize that Rock was gone and Austin was now had turned, and who was going to fill that void. It was, you know, and you really let the air out of the ball. You had to turn Austin, though, I believe. In retrospect, I think it was the right thing for business, because I believe you heat things up to cool them off to heat them back up again. I think if Austin would have been physically in better shape, his body had broken down and had put himself through so much through all the years that he wasn't able to have that renaissance like we've seen with the Shawn Michaels or an Undertaker, for example, where he was able to come back, turn again, be on top again in that role. But it was the right thing for business, because I think Austin believed, and he had a great feel for what he was doing, that he needed to, that it was time, and that he didn't want to get stale. He wanted to do something different. And then, of course, where he went from there had a lot to do with the players around him, which anytime you have a top guy, whether it's Hogan, whether it's Rock, whether it's Austin, Taker, you've got to feed him the right guys. And if you're not feeding him the right guys, then you don't have as great a guy. And that was one of the issues then after Brock's departure.
Well, Kevin, I want to really thank you for chatting with us, finding out a lot of information that I myself had never heard of before. So thanks very much for this. I want to alert everyone, April 2nd and 3rd on GoFightLive.tv. You can catch Ring of Honor. Honor takes center stage. It's going to be 8 p.m. Friday night, and then they're back 1 p.m. on Saturday afternoon. $19.99 for both shows. So a hell of a deal there for two very, very strong shows. And, of course, you get to hear our good pal Kevin Kelly calling all of the action. So have a great time in Atlanta, Kevin. We are going to be watching, and thanks a lot for this time.
Thank you very much, as always. I love being on with you guys. If anybody, any fans want to share their thoughts about WrestleMania or the Honor Take Center Stage shows, you can reach me on Twitter at RealKevinKelly. I love to hear from the fans on Twitter. It's a great way to keep up, and I'd love to come back on with you guys soon.
So there's some interesting stuff from Kevin Kelly.
Kevin Kelly, yes, who will be a very active WrestleMania weekend.
Yes, April 1st and 2nd, Ring of Honor are presenting
Honor takes center stage at Center Stage in Atlanta, and you can watch those internet pay-per-view events at GoFightLive.tv. $19.99 for both shows, Wei. Mm. So some great stuff that's going to be going on that weekend.
What a great weekend to be a wrestling fan.
There's so much stuff to check out if you're in Atlanta. I mean, it's really growing now to be, you know, there's not just WWE stuff, but you can go there. There's two Ring of Honor events, two Dragon Gate shows, the Hall of Fame, WrestleMania, Access, Wrestle Reunion. Yeah. Colt Cabana and Roddy Piper are doing stand-up comedy stuff down there. Kevin Nash is hosting a some nightclub event where you can go drink with Kevin Nash. There's everything.
I would love to. Yeah. Maybe the Click will show up.
He's party. Saying they will. He's saying they're all going to be there for the Hall of Fame.
Party with the Click.
Party with the Click.
How many
be
people?
In no condition to view the next day. That's the way to spend WrestleMania weekend.
What were you doing last night? I was drinking with Scott Hall. No?
Last call with Scott Hall.
Ah.
Before we get into the feedback, quickly wanted to mention everyone about WrestleMania week that technically kicks off today, Wei. It is Monday for most people listening to this right now. This is day one of WrestleMania week, and you've got The Law to catch as well as Review Away here. And coming up this week, Wei, we're doing shows every single day.
Every single day.
Tomorrow we'll be back with Review a Raw, where we will talk about the Go Home show that's going to be airing tonight in Chicago, which is going to be, I think, a very noteworthy show with The Rock and the Go Home show for WrestleMania.
And Snooki.
In taped format.
If she is in any condition to perform.
10 hours it took them to shoot that.
Wow.
So whatever airs tonight, it'll probably be 3 minutes. Wow. 8 hours.
Okay.
Not a fan of Snooki this week after hearing that story, I gotta say.
Well, what do you expect? That's what she's known for. That's what all these people are known for. They're known for getting drunk and partying and being a mess.
That's what they do.
That's who she is.
Just a quick heads up, everybody, about some guests from this week. Tuesday on Review of Raw, we're going to be chatting with one half of the Ring of Honor Tag Team Champions, Claudio Castagnoli, who's going to be chatting about the events coming up this weekend. Wednesday, Wei, Jim Cornette is going to be here.
Wow.
There's never an excuse needed to have Jim Cornette on the show.
No.
So chatting with him, that should be a lot of fun. And we're definitely going to ask him about what I believe was his last wrestling match, the Gimmick Battle Royal.
About his elimination
eliminating
Bushwhacker Luke.
So Jim Cornette is going to be joining us. And we're working on some other guests for this week. If things turn out what I'm hoping for, it's penciled in that we are going to get to chat with someone who's competing on the WrestleMania card.
Is that right?
I don't want to say it.
Okay.
Because it's going to fall apart then. It's in the air right now, but I would say 70% it's going to happen.
Oh, that's great.
Someone that is competing at WrestleMania this Sunday.
Cool.
So coming up Thursday, Friday, we'll have shows as well, and we're also going to have a show on Saturday to get everybody ready. And then Sunday, of course, there's The Law. So a full week, Wei.
You guys will be so sick of us by WrestleMania. So sick.
You'll be hitting your stop button. Thankfully, that's why we're getting guests, because those are the people you want to hear from rather than us. So that's WrestleMania week, everybody. You can get all the shows, lawradio.podbean.com/feed, and we'll be posting them daily at liveaudiowrestling.com. Subscribe to iTunes. Easiest way, Live Audio Wrestling. Tons of stuff coming up this week, Wei.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get into the feedback. Damn, there's a lot of it. Try and get through as much of this as possible.
Yeah, a lot of you guys watch this show and have a lot to say, so let's start with Ryan Gilbert.
Finished listening to the review of WrestleMania 1. Fantastic work as always, guys. I've never fully watched this WrestleMania from start to finish, just bits and pieces, but the show is an interesting look into how the business was evolving at that time and how much of a gamble it was for the company. I look forward into listening to the review of WrestleMania 17, which in my opinion is probably one of the best manias in history. Question for a future review. Fans have always brought up suggestions, but I would like to know what show or shows, good or bad, do you two want to discuss on the show? I would like to get more of an insight on your personal tastes in wrestling. Anyway, great shows as always. These podcasts have made the hours at work just fly by. I would think you guys have heard us enough. You probably have a good idea of what we like and what we don't like.
But I think Ryan's just suggesting shows that we actually want to watch and want to talk about.
I think we have a fairly good mix. Like, I mean, we don't always go for stuff that's bad. I mean, we just reviewed WrestleMania 17, which, I mean, is hard to complain about at all.
Yeah.
So we try and mix it up. I think sometimes we're you guys worry about us being so down on watching bad shit. We try to mix it up with some good shit.
Yeah, and like truth is, even some of the bad shows, I do kind of look forward to watching.
Me too. It's never too much of a chore. Yeah.
Greg Brown, just listened to the WrestleMania 1 review, and I'd like to share Way's praises of giving cameramen credit during broadcasts.
Yes.
In sports in particular, the people working the camera deserve far more credit than they receive. I appreciate the efforts of Mike Tenay through both TNA and WCW to mention the great job by the guys in the production truck. Moments in matches like McMahon's face during his match with Hogan at WrestleMania 19 will be remembered because of the great camera work these people provide. Now, in Barry Windham WrestleMania style, I'm going to the kitchen to get some food now.
That's nice. I understand what Greg is saying. That being said, had Jim Ross, when they showed Vince McMahon peering up above the apron,
yeah,
said, "What great work by the cameraman,"
yeah.
It would have totally burst the bubble. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's selective.
You know,
in the right time frame, sure.
I think the...
You don't want to break that wall too much.
Exactly. And I think the sign of any good TV production guy, and this goes for the director, the lighting guy, the everything, down to the commentator, the sign of a good job done by any of those people is if nobody says anything. If it goes unnoticed, then you've done a good job, because it's not your job to really put yourself out there and be noticed.
Very true. Alexander Rios, just heard the WrestleMania 1 review, which was top-notch. I was 1.5 when WrestleMania 1 first aired, which today, it's shocking that it aired for free on closed-circuit television when you consider the prices of even a substandard pay-per-view event of 2010-11. And to me, it's a testament to how much the business of pro wrestling has changed. It wasn't free, closed-circuit. Like, you still had to spend money to see this on closed-circuit, and that's how they made money. Oh, sure, Vince McMahon still sits atop Titan Towers and still uses celebrities to spice up WrestleMania, but the wrestlers of 85 were over the top and larger than life, and you believed it when you saw them. In today's WWE, watching Raw or any pay-per-view, I feel like I'm watching a bunch of frat boys trying very hard to be superstars, and quite frankly, it's not working for me. In fact, I may be one of the few who praise Triple H for burying the locker room at the start of his feud with Taker, because that is how I feel, too. Triple H, Undertaker, and The Rock may be the last three men among the boys.
Wow.
Follow-up. To me, WrestleMania 17 is the top of the heap when it comes to pro wrestling, though I'm sure someone will respectfully disagree. It's the kind of show and supercard where if you want to introduce to a new wrestling fan, this is what you show them on DVD. WWE was white hot, The Rock was wrestling full-time, Austin was relatively healthy, and Triple H and Taker were 10 years younger. And guess what? They wrestled here too, but you'd never know it if you watched today's WWE. I remember being 17 and immersed in the product that was the Attitude Era. I may have so much to say about this show, but I'll go out on the trivial tidbit. It was the first ever WWE production that began to feature the Mini-Tron during the wrestler's entrance, in addition to their standard Tron video when they came out. Thanks, John and Way. Keep up the great work.
All right. Paul Sayer. WrestleMania 17. I remember this pay-per-view like it was yesterday. It had a loaded card and had some of the greatest superstars on it. In matches such as Jericho versus Regal, Eddie versus Test, TLC, and he goes on to name the card. This is one of the best manias WWE has ever produced. Yes.
John C. WrestleMania X7 is my all-time favorite. I still have fond memories of the pay-per-view itself and still have my VHS copy kicking around in a storage bin in my basement. My favorite match of the night back then was Triple H Undertaker, but seeing most of the matches recently again, Austin Rock was certainly great. The only manias that I've seen live that even come close to it are 19 or 14.
24.
As for the next WrestleMania to review, how about 12?
I feel like we've done these all already, but no, we haven't done 12.
No.
So. Yeah. Dennis Amaya, WrestleMania X7 has to be one of my favorite WrestleManias to date. So many fantastic matches and angles all happening on the show. Despite it being a fantastic show, there were still some terrible matches on the card. China Ivory was a terrible match, and the APA six-man tag had no business being on WrestleMania. The match that comes to mind when I think of this WrestleMania, is TLC 2, which featured so many great and impressive spots. This was my match of the night. Can't wait to hear this review, which I know will be great. If I can suggest a review of a WrestleMania, I would suggest WrestleMania 15, which is usually overlooked in being one of the WrestleManias, because it happened in the hottest period in WWE history. In the entire card, there are only three relatively clean finishes out of a 10-match card. All Vince Russo and his booking. Anyway, thanks for all the awesome and hilarious reviews. Can't wait for the next week with five straight days of review away.
I always recall WrestleMania 15 being so pumped because it was WrestleMania and being such a letdown, that show. Let's go over to Sam Kennerly. WrestleMania X7. I remember watching this live in the UK. As I'm sure you are aware, our pay-per-views air live from 1 till 4 a.m. I was 12 years old at the time and decided to stay up and watch the event live. I got about 2 hours sleep and my mom made me go into school. How heartless. I remember falling asleep in the middle of my languages lesson and woke up with my French teacher shouting to me in French. Safe to say, I was so startled from my slumber that I fell off my chair and immediately repressed the memory of my peers laughing at my expense. If the show wasn't as good as it was, I'd probably have died of embarrassment. However, I feel vindicated by an excellent show.
That's a good story. Next, we have Brian Lindenberg, who sends this to us via email. Great job on the first Mania, guys. Now for 17. There was a lot to like about this event, like Paul Heyman and JR on commentary. Michael Cole was backstage where he belongs. As for the matches, I like the hardcore match. By garbage wrestling standards, it was decent. The gimmick battle royal was cool, and the tag titles still actually meant something. The street fight was another high point, as was the Angle Benoit match, but I hated the multiple squash matches, and will always hate this WrestleMania because of two matches in particular. The first was Austin and Rock. The match itself was great until the end. First of all, at this point, The Rock had begun to sell the stunner in such a ridiculous fashion that he made the move laughable. The tack on the screwjob finish, and the fact that The Rock took a superhuman amount of chair shots and finishers and still kept kicking out, total crap. This match diminished both of these guys in my eyes. The second was Triple H versus The Undertaker. I don't remember much about this match except that at one point the ref went down and they began to brawl through the crowd. This would normally be something exciting, but after they climbed some scaffolding, used a camera or something, Triple H took a weak-looking chokeslam to a huge crash mat below. The camera angle caught just how soft the mat looked, and I would gladly body double for Triple H on this one. Following the chokeslam, Taker jumped off with an elbow that looked about as devastating as landing on a feather bed. The mat was so thick that both guys had difficulty getting off to continue the match. This spot completely took me out of the match until it was mentioned on the Law. I had forgotten that Triple H was a victim of the streak. Just a simple change of the camera angle, maybe to a distance shot, would have made all the difference. Okay, well, not a fan. Well, I mean, I really, those are certainly things you can nitpick about the matches, but I wouldn't say anything that ruined the matches for me whatsoever.
No, I agree. It's, you know, you can always find little things with a show, but I thought overall a solid up and down card.
Especially those two matches.
Yeah, absolutely. Daniel Shahori, my girlfriend brought home the true story of WrestleMania for us to watch on Tuesday. Yes, I am aware how lucky I am having a girlfriend that buys me wrestling DVDs. We both enjoyed it, and I will say that it's certainly worth a look. I felt that I had seen most of this footage before from other DVDs. I didn't learn that much new information, but it's very entertaining. It was also very respectful to Hogan, almost in a sneaky fuck you TNA way, as it was mostly clips of Hogan circa 2005 putting over the WWE. All the matches are pretty great. Good selection. Question. About UFC buying Strikeforce, I don't follow MMA that closely. What I really want to know is, what does this all mean for Batista? I'd be very surprised if they bring in Batista at this point.
Yeah, me too. Dana doesn't seem to be a fan of all that.
I was very impressed with the treatment Hogan got in this DVD. They put him over as like the founding father of Mania.
Well, it's interesting because not only did they put Hogan in a good light on that DVD, but also with this video game, he's all over the cover. They're promoting him. Like,
I think that's almost more THQ than WWE. But the DVD, that's in house.
But WWE is so. They control so much of their branding so closely, you would have to figure that they must have had the okay first.
Oh, they definitely had to okay it, but I mean, with a major partner like THQ, I mean, and their video games have been down significantly over the past 2 years, and WWE is expected to deliver on this contract, and it's like, listen, we want Hogan and Savage, we're getting Hogan and Savage.
Mm-hmm. I think to me, this is just a sign that the WWE is not concerned about TNA as competition at all.
Oh, they're not. I don't feel they are at all.
Promoting Hogan here is a big deal. It's not like it's going to make any difference to anybody. Are you going to watch TNA because Hogan is such a big deal on this DVD?
Not at all.
No. Next, we got Chris Charlton. Just got around to listening to Review and Impact. For the record, Joe was speaking Japanese at the end. Sounded like he was saying "boku no desu" in reference to Okada literally saying "he's my boy," but by using the first person "boku" instead of the more macho wrestler friendly "ore," makes Joe sound like a complete child. Okay. Well, thank you for that.
I'm just glad you got to read that one.
Yeah. Well, I probably butchered it.
Boku. Raymond Bacchus. Hey, guys. Hoping you would have an answer to this question. If WWE programming is now PG, why does the score insist on still having the 15-minute delay? I mean, honestly, if it wasn't for the beautiful and entertaining Renee Paquette, the 15-minute delay is a complete wasted opportunity, in my opinion. I will say I completely agree that I hate the 15-minute delay, specifically because when I watch wrestling now, I like having Twitter on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like everyone is 15 minutes ahead.
Yeah.
That is outside of Canada. I don't think it's so much a PG thing as opposed to it being simply a Canadian content amount of CanCon they have to fit into their prime time hours, and that's why they have that 15 minutes there.
Oh.
If it was just about censoring them, they'd be on a 10-second delay. You don't need 15 minutes for that.
But hold on a second. How is TSN able to get away with showing Raw at 9 o'clock for so many years without doing that?
Because inevitably, whatever was airing there, they met their CanCon requirements for prime time programming.
So, but what else is the score airing?
Score could have, I don't know what kind of programming they have leading into it.
Don't they have, like, horse racing or something?
Horse racing was another thing.
CanCon.
Yeah, that was put there specifically to enhance their CanCon at that hour.
Their primetime hours are from 8 till 12, right?
Be 7 to 11.
7 to 11, okay. And what American broadcasting do they have aside from Raw?
I don't know. I don't know their lineup off the top of my head.
I think it's just all local stuff. Like, it's either hockey highlights or basketball highlights or something.
I don't know the answer.
Well, we'll find out for you guys, because we know some
people. We will answer that by the end of the week and find out for sure.
Oh. Ah.
Can you do a quick thing with us here?
What?
Be edited.
I'm sick.
We're joined here by Chad Midgley, the head of programming at the Fight Network, and we have a question from a viewer that wants to know, why does Raw start at 9:15 on the score as opposed to 9 o'clock when TSN got to air it?
Do you want the real answer?
Yes.
Because it's Canadian content live problems.
So how could TSN air it at 9? Do they not have the same...
Here's the deal. Both licenses are different. So when the score airs it, they're already maxed out on their live content on a weekly basis. So right now...
So it's not on a nightly.
No, this is specific to the show. Yeah, it's based on the week. So these 2 hours of live programming, which are now not considered live because it's 9:15, it's technically on tape delay, allow them to stay within their CRTC regulations.
There you go, everybody. You ask a question and we go to a source.
Thank you.
So there you go, everyone. Chad Midgley with the answer here. Yes. A special run-in here on Review Away. So let's keep going here. What was the next? You're up. Ahmad Butt.
Yes, that's right. Ahmad Butt. I know Chris loves Booker as a commentator, but I'm watching Elimination Chamber 2011, and Booker says, "Can't see a guy winning this match with the name Punk. Your name is Booker T." Setting aside the fact Booker's name is just as stupid as CM Punk, Hulk Hogan, The Rock, Iron Sheik have all been world champions, and each have stupid names.
Triple H.
This brings me to my larger point that Booker sucks at announcing. One, he repeats phrases a lot, like, he's going to do it. Two, he's not at all a smooth talker, so everything he says is awkward sounding. And three, he's not witty or fast on his feet enough to battle with Cole's insults.
I agree. I'm not a big fan of Booker T at all, and it's just an overall, I just find it's not smooth at all.
Yeah.
I find... Regal is watching the first episode of NXT this season. I mean, he was very rough around the edges. He was very nervous, but I saw so much more upside. It's like I can see this guy totally working himself into this role and being really, really good. Whereas Booker, I just find is just, it just doesn't have good chemistry. Michael Cole just calls him on everything he fucks up and magnifies it, which doesn't help. And there's times, it's like the day after, I'll see people writing quotes that Booker mentions during the show that I totally miss, and if you go back and you like this, I can't see a guy like named Punk winning this. I'm not a fan, and it's
I agree,
you know,
he seems out of place, and he's just not a broadcaster. He's a great wrestler, but not a broadcaster.
Yeah. We'll go over to Chad Rivera. Hey, guys, just had an idea for the segment that you guys are looking for to add to the Law Review Away family. How about a top 10 segment or show? I've always been a fan of these type of columns on the internet, and I think you guys could put on a hell of an entertaining show. The material would never get stale, and there are so many best top 10 or even better worst top 10s you could do in the world of wrestling. If you happen to have a guest on, it could make it all the more interesting to see their opinions on stuff from having been in the business. You know that the comment section and opinions would also provide a great feedback segment of the show as well. If John Way or any other readers of this have any opinions, please comment below. Okay, this was lifted right off Facebook, everybody.
Yeah. I think somebody, I think Jay might have mentioned that this was too much work for John and Way, and he's right. It is way too much work.
Kevin Nash, everybody. That's what we're striving for.
I mean, even if it is a top 10, I guess you could fill.
To be honest, I'm not a fan of lists.
No?
Typically.
Okay. Brian Hillhouse, in regards to the name WrestleMania, Billy Jack Haynes, in his psychotic conspiracy theory shoot interview, claims that he went down to Florida to meet Vince McMahon and Hulk Hogan. And in the limo, Vince mentioned he wanted to do a huge event but didn't have a name for it. And Billy mentioned that the Portland Trailblazers had Blazer Mania when they won the NBA championship. So, Howard Finkel being doubted.
Well, consider the source. Richard Lee, hey guys, great job on Mania. I've got the VHS copy that John mentioned on the show, and yes, it is a bitch to find when everything is now in the digital realm. With the upcoming WrestleMania 17 review, I remember watching this on a big screen at Silver City Polo Park in Winnipeg and noted that, of course, admission was $10, but food was still the overpriced popcorn and drinks that you always get. But having worked in concessions, I know that is where you make the cash. Question, though, the second TLC match, do you feel that having Heyman on color helped your experience more than when Lawler was there for the first match at SummerSlam 2000? And lastly, love the idea of the new Law Extra, but try to fit in a couple more stories there and add a tweet of the week for the idiot who says the worst thing possible on the web this week. Anyway, now I know that what happened to those tapes in Winnipeg. He must be hunted down, or at least watch Victory Road without snack food. I'm out.
Oh, he's talking of Rohan.
Remember? Oh, yeah. Rohan,
the tape thief.
The tape thief, who we have no sympathy for.
So what is your opinion? Do you think your Heyman being there helped her?
I was always a much bigger fan of Heyman than Lawler. Heyman added so much. He didn't ever try to get himself over. He just really...
He got the storylines and the characters over.
I thought his first night in WWE doing commentary, I mean, he called like a Benoit Guerrero, whether it be a tag or a singles, and was talking about their New Japan background. And it was just, I loved it myself. Yep. I thought he was great.
Next we have from Carmine Lavieri. I absolutely love the new Law Extra. I like the idea of a show that covers the little news pieces that fall through the cracks and can't be covered on the Law proper. As far as WrestleMania X7 goes, I don't think there's ever been a more exciting Mania. Austin's heel turn at the end was in retrospect a terrible decision and pretty much marked the end of the Attitude Era, the most lucrative period the WWF ever had. And then he goes on to say, Austin was really going to stay a heel. His friend said he would stop watching WWF forever. I guess he wasn't the only one.
A ton of people ended up tuning out over the next year, and I think the Austin heel turn had a lot to do with that. Mo from Vancouver, suggestion for the Law Extra. I would love to hear some old Law archive shows. It would be great to hear a few snippets of the Law from the week WCW was bought out by the WWF back in 2001, or the show that revolved around the Chris Benoit tragedy in 2007. I started listening to the Law in 2009, so I've got a lot of catching up to do. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Michael Mercy, Highway, and John, regarding the new segment After the Law, while I admire your endless enthusiasm and energy for creating wrestling-related podcasts, I think the new segment After the Law is veering towards overexposure for you two. You've already got the Raw, Impact, and Retro show reviews, which is twice as much content than any podcast I know. Also, the news covered in the new segment seems like it wasn't a big enough deal to be covered on the Law itself. It feels like velocity. If you really want to cover these smaller news stories, maybe you should give it to two up-and-coming hosts and add it on the end of Review Away. Help get two new guys over, much like how having your segment After the Law helped get you two guys over. Maybe give it to a pair of longtime listeners who have a gift of gab. Just my two cents. Keep up the great work, and remember to stockpile up on some energy drinks if you're going to keep up at this pace.
Okay, so yeah, thanks. So Michael wants to host a show.
Well, I just don't know who else we can get inside the office.
We can get we'll get Brad. That'd be fun. Just read him stories and have him react.
let's cut that out.
All right, Richard Fulford. Review Away asked on a recent show for ideas for a filler for the show, and I have one. How about interviewing listeners about their unconditional love of the Squared Circle? Unlike the normal celeb interview, it would be cool to hear about what listeners like and how they got into wrestling. Think of it as a shoot interview with fans for fans.
Okay, cool.
So there we go, everybody. Lots of feedback from you, and we appreciate all of it, as always. This show has gone very long at this point, everybody, and I think we're going to wrap things up right now because it's about that time. So a big thank you to Kevin Kelly. You also heard from Steve Austin on the show, and all of your feedback, which you can always post on the Live Audio Wrestling Review Away Facebook group, or easier, just go to reviewaway.com, and we always appreciate that feedback. And of course, WrestleMania week continues starting today and continuing on throughout the whole week with shows Tuesday through Saturday. You can go to liveaudiowrestling.com or lawradio.podbean.com/feed, or just subscribe on iTunes to Live Audio Wrestling. So way, as we wrap things up, next week, we're going to stay with the WrestleMania theme, but veer off a little from a WrestleMania event, because we got tons of feedback to this WrestleMania 17, and we're going to go and we're going to review the Raw from the very next night, where they actually headlined Raw that night with a rematch between The Rock and Steve Austin in a steel cage match. So we're going to see how they took Austin as a heel and introduced him on Raw the next night, and how they followed up. Tons of stuff. This was the first Monday unopposed with no Nitro. So a very, very historic Raw to look back on.
And the Raws after WrestleMania are always huge, huge episodes. And
like the season premiere.
Exactly. And they're almost bigger than some pay-per-views that take place throughout the year. So I'd love to watch it and compare it to the Raw after this WrestleMania.
Yes. So it's the April 2nd, 2001 edition of Raw from, I believe, Fort Worth, Texas, if I'm not mistaken.
Track it down. If you can.
I'm going to... we will hopefully find this, and if we can't find it, we might send out an SOS on the Facebook wall. So we'll close out, everybody. WrestleMania week shows throughout the whole week leading into WrestleMania on Sunday night, and then tune into The Law, 11 p.m. Eastern. It's a special three-hour edition of The Law this coming Sunday, and then Review Away is back next Monday morning, really early Monday morning, with our review of Raw from the night after Mania 17. Mm-hmm. So lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of audio from The Law coming up in the next week. So Way, let's end us off. We've been doing our countdown of WrestleMania theme songs. What have we done so far? Number five was Step Up. Then we had your pick, which was the WrestleMania rap.
Yes.
Then mine last week was Big Time by Soundtrack of Our Lives, and now we're down to the final two. And number two is your choice. So what was number two?
Number two, according to me, the best WrestleMania song of all time is Big Time by Peter Gabriel.
What? They used the theme... What? They used the same title of a song twice?
Yes, they did.
Back-to-back years?
Back-to-back, and this is the better one.
This was a fun one because it was meant to be, oh, Big Time. Literally not understanding the meaning of this song. It was like all like anti-commercialism, like anti-everything that WrestleMania represented.
Yes.
So here we go. Peter Gabriel to kick us off. Peter Gabriel to end us off. And then we're back tomorrow. We've been talking for way too long.
much larger than life.